Ghislaine Maxwell, serving a 20-year sentence for her role in Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking crimes, was interviewed by the Department of Justice under the Trump administration, sparking renewed interest in Epstein's network. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, a former Trump lawyer, met Maxwell in Tallahassee, Florida on July 24th through the 25th to probe potential information about others involved in Epstein's crimes.
I think Ghislaine did a wonderful job. She literally answered every question. She didn't say, you know what, don't ask me that. I'm not going to talk about this person. She was asked maybe about 100 different people. She answered questions about everybody, and she didn't hold anything back.
But her lawyer, David Oscar Marcus, declined to disclose specifics. The speculation fueled by this interview and the lingering question of a pardon concerning Maxwell revolve around Epstein's alleged ties to foreign entities, not just politicians and celebrities, as the plot thickens.
But a lot of people have asked about pardon. This is just not a time to be talking about pardons. Todd will come back with whatever he's got. You're making a very big thing over something that's not a big thing. You should be talking about, if you're going to talk about that, talk about Clinton, talk about the former president of Harvard, talk about all of his friends, talk about the hedge fund guys that were with him all the time. Don't talk about Trump.
The Democrats pushing Trump on this and trying to connect him to all of this has massively backfired. And I've been saying for 20-plus days since this all broke, Trump needs to lean into this and order everything released, and that's all starting. Democrat judges all over the country, Florida, New York, are trying to block the release of the Epstein files now.
Evidence suggesting Epstein's connections to Mossad and Russian entities continues to burrow down the rabbit hole.
So $21 trillion disappeared from DOD and HUD over the period that Epstein was operating. He went to the White House, his first time in the White House. Rubin, who became Secretary of Treasury, took him, I think, in 1994, and then Rubin goes to Treasury. Money starts disappearing, and then, you know, Epstein is ballooning fantastic amounts of money. So I think Epstein was laundering the money that was coming out of DOD, and if you look at his relationships with Mossad and Israeli intelligence, when Mossad is taking over DOD and the money's going missing, and we know the cybersecurity and IT in the Israeli sort of constellation was very active, you know, in government at that time. So if you let the files out, people are going to connect the dots between Epstein, Mossad, the growing power of Israel, AIPAC, and then where did their pension fund money go?
Of course, Ghislaine's father, Robert Maxwell, was alleged in books like Robert Maxwell's Israel Super Spy to have worked with Mossad. Similarly, Epstein's ties to Russian figures such as Sergei Belyakov, a former Russian official who assisted Epstein with a Russian model and visa issues, and Epstein's processing of millions through Russian banks suggest possible Russian intelligence interest. Ghislaine Maxwell's own activities also add to the scrutiny, particularly her Terramar project, a nonprofit founded in 2012 to promote ocean conservation, which likely functioned as a shell company. The New York Post reveals that Terramar, which shut down after Epstein's 2019 arrest, had minimal financial transparency and was linked to Epstein's funding of his illicit network, raising questions about its true purpose. The Terramar project raised approximately $197,000 in public donations over its operational years from 2012 to 2019. Maxwell loaned significant sums to keep the organization afloat, with tax filings indicating that by 2017, the nonprofit owed her $539,000. And by the end of 2018, this debt had increased to $561,000. The Terramar project was endorsed by the Clinton Global Initiative in 2013, but direct financial contributions are not clearly documented. Ghislaine's tech billionaire boyfriend at the time, Ted Waite, once donated $10 million to the William J. Clinton Foundation and was essential in getting the Terramar project funded. There are plenty more rocks that have yet to be turned over as the Epstein saga stumbles onward. John Bound reporting for InfoWars.
It's almost poetic, the products that we sell, because yes, they are the best. Yes, it is the best price for the highest quality. Yes, they are third-party tested. It's almost poetic because as we advocate for humanity, what we sell to you is that which makes you or allows you to make yourself a better version of yourself. Whether it's getting the methylene blue, which helps you with focus and energy and mental clarity, or ultimate life force, which makes your body healthier in so many ways I don't have the time to explain to you. Whether it's the Shilajit that gives you incredible vitality, or the ultimate burn, which ensures that your metabolism is optimal, or the optimal human, which is everything the body needs. You see, we're fighting for your mind, your body, and your soul, not just with the products that we sell, but with the message of this network. We have to have the truth. We have to have freedom of speech. We have to have our rights, because, folks, we're about ready to go into an artificial intelligence war, into a space war, the likes of which humanity couldn't even dream of, even in science fiction. So please go to thealexjonesstore.com right now, not just for your mind and your body, but for your species.
It's Wednesday, July 30th, in the year of our Lord, 2025. And you're listening to The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now at band.video.
I think it's time to blow this thing, get everybody in the stuff together. Okay, 3, 2, 1, let's jam.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The American Journal. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this morning, this Wednesday morning, July 30th, 2025. And it's going to be a big day, folks. It's going to be a big day. Tonight, I believe at 9 Central, Nick Fuentes will be debating Alex Jones on the topic of Trump and Epstein. And, you know, maybe we should pull in some videos from this. I know Nick talked about it yesterday, and I'm very excited to hear the debate. You know, I think Nick and Alex basically have the same, more or less the same read on the situation. I think the main difference is, well, I don't know, age and experience maybe would be the main difference, because I think, you know, Alex has been under such sustained attack. Obviously, Nick's been censored and stuff as well, but nothing compared to what Alex has been under. Although, to be fair, the cops did kill a guy who tried to kill him, who, you know, showed up at Nick's house with a gun. So to be fair, he's been through a lot too. So not so much experience, but age. In that, I've always said I interpreted Nick's opposition to Trump during the 2024 campaign as a long-term strategy, basically recognizing that either Trump's going to lose and Kamala's going to be in office, and that's going to be the situation we're going to have to deal with, or even if Trump wins 4 years after that, Trump will be gone, and, you know, somebody else will have to pick up the torch, or, you know, just it's yet to be seen what the fate of MAGA into the future is. So it seemed to me like Nick was trying, sort of playing the long game. And, you know, looking into the future, after all, he's a very young man, whereas Alex is like under attack, under massive attack, being sued into oblivion. They're trying to throw him in jail for a variety of different reasons. And it's like, we don't have multiple rounds to like wait out the enemy. If the Democrats get back in power, they will do everything they possibly can to throw us in prison. And I know Alex has talked about, you know, being the warrior in exile, because it'll be literally be too dangerous to be in America, because it'll be just complete anarchy and persecution from the top on down. And so when it comes to Trump and Epstein, it's not even like Alex is covering, you know, what Trump's doing and trying to spin it so it looks good. He's trying to figure out what's actually going on, just like we all are, trying to determine what exactly are the motives behind what Trump is doing, and are these really mistakes that he's making, or is this part of a longer game? Is this the right thing to focus on in terms of the future of our country? I mean, I've seen a lot of people online recently talking about what a devastating effect the Epstein scandal is having on Trump. I mean, his approval ratings have collapsed, basically just in lockstep with every development of the Epstein story. And people are pointing out, like, we're having massive success on tariffs. You know, the deportations are happening at a pace. Lee Zeldin, the EPA director, just basically undercut and abolished the, like, central pillar of the entire climate change agenda. So we're having massive success, but it's not translating to political support because of this Epstein thing hanging over the entire administration. Again, that's entirely Trump's fault. It's entirely his administration's fault. I mean, the way that they're handling this Epstein situation, it's no wonder it's causing their approval to collapse. But I can at least understand the argument of, hey, we should drop this and focus on Trump's wins because we got to, you know, be building political capital right now. So when the midterms comes, we aren't blown out of the water. So I sort of get that argument. So I don't know. So it'll be interesting to see Alex and Nick talk. And then we're going to do a Moonbase Live afterwards. I'm going to be joined by Lebanon John and Rex Jones to break down the debate. Little post-debate recap that I already regret. That I already regret staying up super late to do. But the debate begins, I believe, at 9 central. Which means it probably won't be over till like 11 or so. So we'll be staying up late. We'll be staying up late tonight. And I hope that you tune in to both of those broadcasts. And we're going to try to get some other guests on as well, but Rex and John have already confirmed. So that's going to be very exciting. We got a lot of other big news that broke yesterday and developing this morning. And we'll get to all of that. Major tsunami warnings for like half of the world yesterday. But as far as I can tell, no catastrophic tsunamis as were expected. And perhaps that's because we all learned our lesson with those tsunamis a couple decades ago. And it's actually kind of cool. World's biggest quake in 14 years. Massive 8.8 mag Russian island West Coast alert. I think Hawaii was under alert for 12-foot tsunami waves. We'll show you those stories. But I guess it was a long time ago. What was the? It was like the Indonesian tsunamis. 2004, I was going to say about 10 years ago. And like in those days, it seems weird. It was only 10 years ago, but like nobody knew any, sorry? Oh, 20 years ago. It was 20 years ago. Okay. Yeah, longer. Okay. A lot longer ago than I thought. Feels like 10 years ago for me. But if you weren't around then, 20 years ago, it was like nobody knew what tsunamis were somehow. And like everybody died. It was crazy. There are all these videos of, you know, the water receding because before tsunamis, the water recedes massively and then it rushes back in. And since I guess nobody knew about that, the water rushed out and everybody was just like, wow, cool. The ocean is gone. Let's go collect shells. So they all ran out into the ocean. And so when the tsunami comes, they were all screwed. And there were stories where it was like one island. Some like sixth grade girl had just learned about tsunamis in school and so told everybody, hey, this is a tsunami coming. We should all get to higher ground and like saved everybody on the island. It's just interesting that 20 years ago, it was like nobody knew about tsunamis. Now everybody knows, which is nice. It's kind of like 9/11 truth. It's like, yeah, somehow nobody knew this 20 years ago. Now everybody knows. It's interesting how that works. We got a lot of videos to show you. We got a lot of stories to get into. Let's begin today, as we do every day, with our Daily Dispatch. All right, here it is, folks, your Daily Dispatch for Wednesday, the 30th of July, 2025. Trump says Epstein was banned from Mar-a-Lago for poaching young women, including Virginia Giuffre, from his spas. President Trump said on Thursday his relationship with sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein ended after the New York financier stole a young female employee from Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort after being warned not to do so. Quote, he took people that worked for me and I told him don't do it anymore and he did it and I said stay the hell out of here, he said. Trump was asked to clarify comments he made over the weekend where he implied Trump had been banned from Mar-a-Lago for targeting club staff. When pressed further, he acknowledged the staff members involved included young women, including Virginia Giuffre, who worked at Mar-a-Lago as a pool attendant. That's not true. Not a pool attendant. She was a spa worker. I told him, I said, listen, we don't want you taking our people, whether it's from the spa or not spa. I don't want him taking people. And he was fine. And then not too long after that, he did it again. And I said, out of here. he said, saying Epstein stole his spa workers. The conversation would go to Virginia Giuffre, the former Mar-a-Lago pool attendant who was recruited by Ghislaine Maxwell after sexually and later sexually abused by Epstein. When asked if she was among those Epstein poached, Trump responded, "I think she worked at the spa. I think so. I think that was one of the people," he added. "Yeah, he stole her." In previous interviews and public statements, Trump said he severed ties with Epstein because he believed the financier was a creep, pointing to Epstein's 2009 conviction for soliciting underage prostitutes. The reason had been consistently cited by a former president and his allies of evidence of Trump distancing himself from the convicted sex offender. Again, we showed the audio recording last night. It's not a video. It's just an audio only statement from, Air Force One that he made. And obviously the Democrats are trying to spin this as badly as possible, when in reality, it just confirms what we've said about Trump the entire time. This has always been the story. The story was always that, yes, Epstein was a member at Mar-a-Lago and, you know, was pictured and photographed with Trump at parties there and stuff. But then he was, you know, recruiting Trump's employees as a member of the club. And Trump didn't like that, because why would you? Because why would you allow that? Why would you allow people to come in and snipe your personnel and you know, steal your good employees? And they're like, he said stole, taken, as if these women were property. Like, well, that was the question that was asked. The reporter said, didn't Epstein take girls from you? And so Trump responded, yes, he took girls from me. So it was literally the reporter asking the question and Trump just responding using the same vocabulary. And they're like, see, he was trafficking girls. Obviously, he didn't know what Jeffrey Epstein was doing with them. But obviously, he wasn't good friends with him. Like, he just did, you know, this whole claim of like Trump's best friend Epstein. And it's like their connection was 30 years ago. Trump was like, where's that nice employee we had? Jeffrey Epstein took her? He took her out of our spa? Okay, well, he can't come back then. Well, then he can't come back. Like, oh, I thought they were best friends. So again, I mean, it just, again, confirms everything that we've been saying about Trump the entire time. This has been the story the entire time. It's completely consistent in all of it. And we showed the video yesterday on the War Room, Virginia Giuffre saying, you know, Trump's treated me great. I never saw them being involved in anything. And she even, of course, endorsed him for president, again, confirming the fact that Trump was not involved with Jeffrey Epstein's salacious activity.
I've got a crazy one for you.
Go for it.
So the Palm Beach Post yesterday had an article, Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell survivor, testified she met Donald Trump at age 14. You go down to the first key point here, said that she stated that she met Trump with Epstein at Mar-a-Lago when she was 14, that she was a contestant at a Teen USA pageant, but did not describe any inappropriate behavior by Trump. It's like the headline would get you to think, like, oh yeah, this, you know, age 14-year-old girl was getting sexually abused by Epstein and Trump probably at the same time. And the first key point is that she did not allege any misconduct.
Yeah, it's, again, the purpose of the mainstream media is to tell you the truth, but leave you believing a lie. So they didn't say, that wasn't Virginia Giuffre, that was a different victim, I guess.
It's a Jane. She's unidentified.
A Jane Doe. Again, I mean, do we have to go over it over and over again? I guess so, because, again, everything we know about Trump and Epstein is completely inconsistent with the way Trump is acting now with Epstein. And I'm as sick of talking about it as anybody else, but the Democrats have decided that they really care about elite pedophilia all of the sudden. I have to say, the gall of these people, the temerity of this cacophony of scum. In fact, I tweeted it out yesterday because I'm not a glutton for punishment, but I do like to keep my finger on the pulse of our enemies. So I go to Reddit every once in a while, and I just scroll down the front page. Just get my adrenaline pumping, you know, just feel the rage building. As you see the just incredibly, incredibly st- stupid crap that they just genuinely believe with all their heart. It really is infuriating. And I'm scrolling down the, you know, main page of Reddit, which obviously has been censored into oblivion and is just like a total leftist echo chamber now. But like every other post pretty much is a post, J.D. Vance protects elite pedophiles. Donald Trump, it was just every post, Epstein, elite pedophilia. Why are they protecting pedophiles? It's like you absolute animals. You beasts of the field, you monsters, spent 10 years mocking the very concept of elite pedophilia, making entire shows where like the underlying premise was a mockery, a parody of QAnon, just lambasting the entire concept of wealthy people kidnapping children to use as sex slaves. They have scuttled any attempt to get the truth out about this. They have defended the pedophiles with every breath in their body. They have gone to the ends of the earth to criticize and mock and deride all of the genuine concern from the right about the cabal of pedophiles that runs our country. Only now, when they think it can hurt Donald Trump, it becomes their number one topic, their number one issue. These people aren't people. They're scum. They're pond scum. They're the moral worth of mud on the ground. I hate them. I really do hate them. Really, genuinely, genuinely hate all these people. And it's hard not to. I'll tell you, it's hard not to. I mean, same thing's happening with the censorship in the UK, where these people are censoring the internet, going on TV and saying, if you oppose this bill, you're basically Jimmy Savile. We showed that clip yesterday. The technology minister of Britain was on Sky News being asked about the new online safety act, which just was immediately implemented not to stop children from accessing pornography or anything like that, but to stop adults from accessing political content, because that's obviously the point of the entire thing. And this guy comes on and talks about Nigel Farage says this is a bad bill. We have to be able to talk about the consequences of the policies that our governments are implementing in order to have a democracy. And this guy says, well, that puts Nigel Farage on the same side of Jimmy Savile, notorious necrophiliac, satanic child rapist. He's basically the same as Nigel Farage, because Jimmy Savile would probably, if he was around now, he'd probably be using the internet to get victims. And so Nigel Farage is really, in a way, helping the Jimmy Saviles out there. He's on the same side of Jimmy Savile. And it's just, there's something about the people who spend decades doing everything they possibly can to maximize the abuse of children. After all, a million British girls have been raped by immigrants. And it's just the irony of the Online Safety Act, passed ostensibly to stop child sex abuse, is in fact only being used to silence opposition to immigration. Immigration being the number one cause of child abuse in the UK by a factor of like 100. So the irony, the hypocrisy, the cynicism, where just they just don't. And it's like, it's not even hard. How hard is it to care about children being trafficked? Like, but for 10 years or more in the case of, you know, the UK and the cover-ups of the rape gangs. Decades, these people do everything they possibly can to silence anybody speaking up about the rampant abuse of children by elites, by immigrants, by whoever. Shut up, you racist, you bigot, whatever else, you conspiracy theorist, Christian nationalist, danger to democracy. Only for them to use that same sentiment to justify their tyrannical behavior. We just have to beat these people. There's no arguing about it. Meanwhile, 8.8 magnitude earthquake hits off Russia's Far East. One of the strongest earthquakes ever recorded struck off Russia's sparsely populated Far East early Wednesday, sending tsunami waves into Japan, Hawaii, and the U.S. West Coast. Several people were injured, but none gravely, and no major damage has been reported so far. Authorities warn the risk from the 8.8 magnitude quake could last for hours, and millions of people potentially in the path of the waves were initially told to move away from the shore or seek higher ground. But the danger already appeared to be lessening in some places, with authorities downgrading their warnings in Hawaii, Japan, and parts of Russia. Residents fled inward as ports flooded on Kamchatka near the quake's epicenter, while frothy white waves washed up on the shore of northern Japan. Cars jammed the streets and highways in Honolulu with standstill traffic, even in areas away from the sea. And, you know, luckily there were not any catastrophic tsunami waves, but certainly this was a... This should be a lesson for the people there, as we saw massive traffic jams in places like Hawaii of people all trying to get to the higher ground all at once. And there were all these stories of, like, Oprah has a private road that she wasn't opening to allow people to evacuate. It's one of those, luckily, I guess, a little bit of a false alarm. But if I was one of the people on Hawaii, I'd be thinking, you know, we should have a plan in place. We should have a better plan in place, so we aren't all sticking in stuck in gridlock traffic while trying to escape a tidal wave. I believe I have another. We got some more stories about that. We'll get to in a second. Meanwhile, South Park features Cartman as Charlie Kirk in new episode. Next episode of South Park to be released Wednesday, August 6th, will feature Eric Cartman acting as a character resembling Turning Point USA's Charlie Kirk. In a trailer posted by South Park X account, Cartman can be seen with hair that resembles Kirk sitting at a table with a microphone, as Kirk does during his debates with students on college campus. You hate America and you love abortion, Cartman says in the trailer. Kirk responded to the South Park clip by making Cartman his profile picture on X and responding, "I'm so watching this." The show is now in its 27th season, kicking off with controversy after starting a plot line that features a reoccurring character, Satan, and President Donald Trump. On Thursday, White House spokesperson Taylor Rogers condemned the show in remarks to multiple outlets, calling South Park a fourth-rate program that has been relevant for over 20 years and is hanging on by a thread of uninspired ideas and a desperate attempt for attention. Oof. Oof. It is true, though. It is pretty true, though.
Sounds like South Park got under his skin.
I don't know. I mean, it's one thing to say, like, South Park, this was offensive, and we didn't like this. But there's, like... Yeah, whatever. You know, South Park is just not relevant anymore. They don't quite have the bite they used to. And look, it's a shame because there's so much fodder for comedy out there. And it ain't on the right, folks. And of course, the debate's been going on social media. People going, South Park makes fun of both sides. Look, they made fun of Al Gore 25 years ago. With Man Bear Pig, as if, you know, those characters weren't treated sympathetically the entire time anyway. Or, like, I guess Obama got made fun of at one point. But, like, obviously there's a difference between making fun of Hillary Clinton in 1998 and then going soft on the left for 20 years, only to come back making fun of Trump. It's just like, if there was one show that you would think could buck the trend and not just dish out the same hogwash that we get everywhere else, you'd think it'd be South Park. You'd think they'd continue their tradition of, you know, breaking the mold and providing new creative and, you know, unprecedented perspectives on the world around us. But no, they've just become libtards and they just hate Trump, and great, you're like everybody else now. Very exciting.
Please remember that this broadcast is only as powerful as you make it. When you share the live feed from Real Alex Jones on X, on your email list or text message, on other platforms, word of mouth on X, it changes the world. When you share the feed from Infowars.com/show, it changes the world. So remember, Paul Revere's, you're not part of the solution, you are the solution, you're everything. When you share the live feed, when you share the clips of the show, when you send that out to everyone you know, that's the reach, the amplification, that is 99% of this operation. You are the whole shooting match, and the InfoWar is everything, and you are the mind, the bones, the guts, the blood, the will, the soul. of the InfoWar. So release your will and power now. Destroy them. Huge announcement, ladies and gentlemen. I am beyond excited about this. I've wanted this knife for a year. It's super high quality. They finally got the right supplier and a bunch of them. It's in a beautiful keepsake black box with my signature in silver lettering on the top. And when you go inside, this incredible combat battle dagger, limited edition Alex Jones signature battle dagger, a high-tech, super high-quality sheath with a high-tech clip onto your belt or your pants. And it's got a special system where the knife doesn't come out when it's upside down. It takes a little pull to get it out. It is amazing. This is, in my opinion, the very best defense battle dagger you can get. It's at an incredible price for $79.99 right now. This knife by itself in store sells for $100 every day, but we bought 5,000 of them, so got the price down really low. Wholesale, so we can pass that on to you, and the profit we make goes in to fund this operation. So you don't just get a great defensive system for yourself and your family, great in your car, great on your side, great in your purse, your glove compartment, also skin a buck with it, whatever you need. This is an amazing knife. You not only, though, get something to defend yourself, you defend the Republic in the information war by funding this operation. So get your limited edition Alex Jones signature battle dagger at thealexjonesstore.com right now, and it keeps this operation on the air. This isn't just a blade. It's a symbol of freedom. Limited edition Alex Jones signature battle dagger is forged by patriots ready to defend the Republic from the globalist agenda, featuring a double-edged black-coated blade for unmatched durability and precision. This dagger is built to last. On one side is etched my signature, while the other side proudly bears 1776, a reminder that the spirit of revolution lives on stronger than ever. With its ergonomic non-slip grip designed ready for any mission, the dagger isn't just a tool, it's a statement. Whether you're adding it to your collection or keeping it close as a symbol of resistance and for defense, this blade is for those who know that the answer in 1984 is 1776. Get yours now. And then, we are announcing a limited sale, the Power Drive bundle of Power Plant and Methyl Drive, which goes incredibly good with methylene blue. And both of these give you incredible natural energy, clarity, and focus. But you mix them together with methylene blue, I will tell you, in Chase Geyser's observation himself, 10 times stronger than Turbo Force. Did you hear what I just said? 10 times stronger than Turbo Force. Get yours now, discounted massively, 50% off when you get them together. 50% off on the Power Drive bundle for a limited time, 1 week, at thealexjonesstore.com, and it funds this operation, 1776 worldwide.
Putting the power of conversation into the caller's hands, you're tuned in to the American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the American Journal. Yeah, I think maybe it's time to move on from South Park. And the right sort of has its own kind of South Park style creation. I think Freedom Tunes is kind of right up there with South Park. Obviously, it's not full shows. We sort of got screwed over because a lot of the effort, time, and energy that conservatives put into creating comedy or, you know, entertainment that's only pseudo-political, it all got spearheaded by Daily Wire, and they are not funny or edgy at all. So maybe it's me that's failing. Maybe we need to be producing something like South Park, where it can just be funny on its own, but also have political messages underlying it. Again, I'm just disappointed in South Park. In and how they let the left sort of get away with everything. I guess they have like PC principle to make fun of like political correctness.
Dude, PC principle's character arc.
I don't know. I haven't really been following the show that much. I mean, I really don't watch it anymore. I used to watch it.
Used to be addicted to it.
I mean, yeah, there have been times in my life where like, you know.
South Park is life.
You wake up, turn it on, it just sort of plays in the background all day.
Zip up your jacket.
It's a very good show. I'm not even knocking the show. It is.
Yeah, I don't know if it's $5 billion good.
Yeah, that's the thing. They offer it. Well, and maybe that was part of it, right? They got offered so many billions of dollars to keep doing it. And, you know, maybe part of that had to do with, you know, and it's funny because, like I said, I, you know, watch stuff on the left sometimes. And there was a podcast I was listening to the other day because it just popped up in my YouTube feed. I don't know if YouTube does this for y'all, but you scroll through your feed and it's just like a bunch of stuff you've already watched before and a bunch of stuff you're subscribed to. And then they'll just drop in randomly podcasts with like less than 100 views. And it's really weird how it does it. And there are hundreds of these podcasts. God knows who these people are.
Feels synthetic.
It doesn't even feel synthetic because it's not popular. It's just, you know, it's probably good for these podcasts. You know, I guess that's what you want on YouTube is, you know, for them to show you small creators, not just the big ones. But it is interesting when you're scrolling through and it's like every video on your feed is like 1 million views, 2 million views, 55,000 views, 12 views. You're like, what? Why is a video with 12 views showing up on my feed? Anyway, so this is what happened. There was some podcast. It was like The Resistance. And first I was thinking it was a right-wing thing, but he was a left-winger. Well, long story short, the left is still, they still think Trump's a tyrant, and they're sort of desperate to find evidence of that. And pretty much all they have at this point is that Stephen Colbert was fired. And so they've concocted this entire mythology around Donald Trump is a tyrant because he gets people who criticize him fired and forces their companies to shut down their shows. And it's like, that's what you have. That's what you is CBS fired Stephen Colbert, therefore Trump is a tyrant. As if, first of all, every show doesn't make fun of Trump. That's on mainstream media. And also every mainstream media show that makes fun of Trump, which is all of them, all fail. They're not funny. Because they're all trying to make the same jokes about the same thing. They're all wrong anyway. And the best humor always has truth at the heart of it, not the retarded lies of the left. And it doesn't even make sense. I mean, they have, you know, Cartman, probably the most famous, well-known and outspoken anti-Semite on television for the last 100 years. And they don't do an episode about Gaza. They don't do an episode where Cartman joins the IDF.
Dude.
And becomes Benjamin Netanyahu.
That is an awesome idea, by the way.
How have they not done, or go the other way and have his anti-Semitism going mainstream and make Cartman the new Hassan. No, they make him Charlie Kirk. You had a chance to make Cartman, you know, a Twitch streamer becoming famous for anti-Semitism, and you don't go with that, you make him Charlie Kirk. As if the right wing are the bullies in this country. It shouldn't make any sense. It's just there's so much opportunity for humor and comedy out there. And they make fun of Donald Trump's spray tan. Okay. Donald Trump is in bed with the devil. Wow. Wow, real,
it was a little tired.
Groundbreaking,
right?
Stuff there. Real iconoclastic stuff going on there.
I could appreciate the callback, but it didn't hit the same, right?
As Saddam.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I can't help but agree. The South Park fourth rate program has been relevant for over 20 years, hanging on by a thread of uninspired ideas in a desperate attempt for attention. They kind of got you. They kind of got you there, South Park.
All right, but the Christmas snow episode?
Still.
I don't even know that one.
For those of you listening and watching right now, there's an episode out there that is their magnum opus.
Well, it's just kind of pathetic. Again, it's like, if it was funny, fine, but I don't know. There's just so much more opportunity for, you know, the South Park style incisive commentary, but they just go with the low hanging fruit. But maybe that's all of our fault for clinging on to these intellectual properties. And God, The Simpsons is still making new episodes. It's like, we not have something new already? How about something new for once? All right, we'll move on. We'll move on though, because again, who really cares about South Park these days? This story is a little bit of a shocker. ICE arrests 214 illegal immigrants for child sex crimes in Houston metro area. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has arrested 214 illegal immigrants in the Houston area over the last 6 months who have been charged or convicted of child sex crimes. This figure surpasses the 211 such arrests made during the entire 2024 fiscal year by the Houston field office. The uptick stems from broader enforcement from the Trump administration after the president came into office pledging to conduct mass deportations with the worst of the worst as a priority. Among those arrested by ICE in the last 6 months who have been charged with or convicted of child sex crimes is Jesus Gutierrez Mireles, 67, from Mexico, who was deported April 4th after convictions for aggravated sexual assault of a child and DWI, according to a press release from ICE. So again, 214 illegal immigrants arrested just in the Houston area for sex crimes against children. 214 people in one city committing sex crimes against children. What? It's just unbelievable the amount of victimization that goes on because of these socialist democratic policies of letting all of the pedophile criminals into our country. And it's like, I guess if you didn't have a understanding of the spiritual underpinning of the global conflict we're engaged in, it might seem confusing to you why pedophilia is so incredibly prevalent in all of these different stories. But there is a spiritual underpinning to all of this, and there's a characteristic of pedophilia that makes it the worst thing you could possibly do, which makes it's the aspect of the shattering of innocence and the victimizing of the most innocent people in the world with the worst possible abuse. It's just like the pinnacle of evil, but everything else is just kind of shades of that. Shades of the taking advantage of innocence, shades of, you know, imposing power on the powerless just because you can. It's like symbolic of just what lies at the heart of everything that we're fighting. And obviously there's been a lot of talk recently. Alex did like an hour on his show yesterday about the gay men who buy babies and they're all pedophiles. And there's this video of these creepy looking big fat dudes with the baby that they purchased. And it's come out that the guy was a sex offender and had been charged with child pornography in the past. And when this happens, a lot of people bring up the experiment, the Kintler experiment in Germany, where the German government put young boys with pedophiles specifically. And I was listening to Alex yesterday and he said, you know, you don't know the half of it when it comes to this program. And you really don't. And I feel like every time this program comes up, I have to remind people of just how bad it was and what the purpose of it was and why it happened in the first place. Right? And that's the obvious question is you hear, okay, the German experiment that placed children with pedophiles. And you have to ask, but why though? But why did they do that? Why did they conduct this experiment? Now, the answer from their perspective is obvious because they're pedophiles and they want children. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, why would the powers that be allow it to happen? What was the justification for allowing it? I mean, they didn't go in and say, hey, German government, we're horny for kids. Can you give us some? And the German government was like, sure, sounds good. No, they had to have a justification for it, right? They had a reason behind it. And the reason was sexual purity is associated with fascism. Is because the guy who conducted the experiment, his dad was a Nazi, he was a homosexual, and he felt oppressed by his father or by the society, the, you know, Nazi cultural dedication or insistence on sexual purity. And so in order to defeat fascism, they thought they would make people gay. I thought, we'll do this experiment and see if raising children in a sexually liberal household will diminish their capacity for fascist activity. That was the reasoning behind it. So they literally said, to fight fascism, we have to give gay pedophiles little boys as sex slaves. To fight, because fascism is the worst thing in the world. You got to fight that with everything you've got. And again, not even as a defense of fascism, but as pointing out to you, and you see it with, you know, Sidney Sweeney has great genes, and everybody's like, oh my God, this is Nazi crap. You get that just things that are normal and good and moral and upstanding and clean and nice and beautiful, these things are fascism to these people. And maybe they're right. I don't know. I'm increasingly convinced that they're correct when they say that this is Nazi propaganda. White people existing is Nazi propaganda. Straight people existing is Nazi propaganda. Saying that pedophiles shouldn't be given little orphan boys as sex toys is Nazi propaganda. So if you really want to get to the heart of like what the two sides are here, is you've got the one side just wants to live in a moral world with, you know, concrete ethical frameworks that allow for innocence and naivety and joy and, you know, simple pleasures, the family, church, things like that. And the other side wants to just tear all of that down, wants to take a blowtorch to all of it, destroy all of it out of seething resentment that they aren't part of it. And it really is as simple as that. You got some homosexual kid that, you know, feels like he can't be a Nazi with all of his friends because he's gay and they're not. And so he wants to like wreak revenge on them by taking their children and giving them to pedophiles. You explain to me the psychological imperative behind that. What compels somebody to, you know, take that course of action. But it's also one of those things where, in fact, maybe now's a good time to go into this story that I've been wanting to cover for a few days, because it is a brilliant use of Grok, and it shows how dangerous AI is under its current controlled manifestation, and it relates to, you know, the Kintler experiment as well. Let me say one more thing about the Kintler experiment. So-called experiment, the gay pedophile orphan ring, sex trafficking ring that they call an experiment. They weren't orphans, actually. Actually, the kids weren't orphans. The children that were used for this experiment were taken from their parents under falsified claims of abuse. So just in case you thought it couldn't get any worse, like it would be bad enough to have some kid whose parents have been killed in World War II. He's alone without protection, being scooped up by the government and placed in the home of a gay pedophile. That would be bad enough. But what actually happened was that there would be a single mother who was like having trouble, you know, working a job and having a kid. And they'd go to her and say, why is your kid not being looked after from 2 to 3? And she'd say, I have a job. He's fine. He's a latchkey kid. He goes home. he's all right. I can't be there for him because I have to work my job. And they said, well, you can't take care of your child. We'll have to take care of him for you. And they take the kid, give him to a gay pedophile, who's a single dad, by the way. Single dad, in quotations. And then they systematically brainwash the kid to hate his own mother. And so it's just like this horrible, tragic story. The whole thing, I mean, they write articles about this. They interviewed the kid. Kid's like, yeah, this guy, you know, raped me, treated me like a sex slave, and basically convinced me it was my mom's fault that this was happening. Said that my mom didn't want to see me and hated me. And, you know, the kid's saying, like, this guy convinced me that when my mom would call and want to come see me, to hang up on her and reject her. And of course, then he like realized what was happening to him later and came clean about it. But there's been no justification. Just understand like the level of evil that we're dealing with and the level of like psychopathy that these people think is justified because after all, they're trying to stop fascism. Under the Kintler experiment of the 1970s, Berlin welfare authorities handed over homeless teenagers to known pedophiles. Yeah, that, and it's like, thing, guys, this is what you have to realize. Even now, they're trying to downplay this. No, what actually happened was they took children from their parents, gave them to pedophiles. The way that article put it was they gave homeless teenagers a place to stay. Even now, when they're writing articles about the experiment that put vulnerable children in the hands of pedophiles, they feel the need to downplay it. They feel the need to fudge it a little bit to make it sound not as bad as it was. These people, man. It's absolutely insane. Okay, so somebody asked Grok on X in response to this picture of the big fat gay pedophiles and the child they bought. They ask, Grok, does this make sense and should it be allowed? Is it fair to the child? Is it fair to the child to deprive them of their biological mother and allow two gay men to purchase the baby? Grok says, based on extensive research from diverse sources, e.g. Oxford, Pew, Heritage, etc., children raised by same-sex parents show comparable or superior outcomes in academics, emotional health, and social adjustment compared to those with opposite-sex parents. It makes sense, should be allowed, and is fair to the child, as loving parents matter most, not gender. Well, very progressive answer, Grok. Is it true, though? Oh, but Grok, are you lying? That's what was asked by somebody. So according to Grok, not only are homosexual parents fine, they're actually better. You actually have better outcomes, academics and social issues. You're actually better off with two big fat gay pedophile fathers, apparently, according to Grok. Until you ask it if that's true or not, in which case it admits, actually, it's completely untrue, and everything I just said was false. Again, this is a major issue with AI. We'll read its responses, its communication with this woman, Katie Faust, who at @advo_Katie. She says, hey, Grok, why don't you give us outcomes for children raised by same-sex parents using only studies that include random participants, not recruited or volunteer participants, and the actual outcomes of children, not self-reporting of parents? Okay, because what the problem is Grok's like, according to all of these diverse studies, everything is great. Like, okay, well, if you look at it, the studies are volunteer, so only people who have had good outcomes are going to come forward to talk about their experience. It was only, you know, a self-selected group of participants, you're going to get completely warped and inaccurate readings of the outcome. In other words, if you, you know, had an exit poll at a theme park, if you polled everybody, made everybody fill out a survey honestly about their experience, and you get an accurate reading. But if it's the type of thing where you go, did you have fun at the park today? Come tell us about it. And only the people who really enjoyed it go to fill it out. Then you're going to find that everybody loves the amusement park. You see what I mean? If you have a self-selected group, you're going to get the wrong outcome. You're going to get an incorrect or inaccurate reading of the situation. So she asked Grok, this conclusion you've come to, this is a superior way of raising children with two gay men. How about now you give me the results not using studies deliberately designed and manipulated to have that outcome? And Grok says, oh, all right. Studies meeting your criteria, random samples, child outcomes, Rosenfield 2010, no difference in school progress. Allen, 2013, 35% lower high school graduation rates. Wow, significantly worse, like more than a third lower, third increase in high school graduation or high school dropouts. Regeneris, 2012, worse on 77 out of 80 measures, e.g. emotional, social, etc. Criticized for instability confounds. Solens, 2015, two times emotional problems. Potter, 2012, lower academic scores. Mixed results. Random studies often show challenges, possibly from family instability or biology. Loving parenting is key, but data varies. Okay, so Grok comes out and says, according to all these studies, you get an equal or better outcome with homosexual parents as you do with heterosexual parents. And then they're asked, okay, why don't you only use studies that are legitimate? And it goes, okay, then it's worse in every possible way. They do worse on 77 out of 80 metrics. They do worse socially. They do worse academically. They do worse in every possible way when you use studies that are legitimate. So Katie Faust continues. Okay, Grok, tell me about the Sarantakos, Barwick, and Siegel and Sarota studies. What did they find, and why don't people cite them? Sarantakos, 1996, found children of same-sex parents in Australia had lower academic scores and more social issues than those with married homosexual parents using teacher ratings. Barwick and Siegel, likely referencing attachment studies, and Sirota, 2009, reported adult daughters of gay or bisexual fathers faced greater attachment anxiety and trust issues. These older, small-sample studies are rarely cited in mainstream research due to methodological flaws, e.g. non-representative samples, confounding divorce effects, and contradicting larger recent evidence showing no harm or better outcomes for such children. So she says, okay, so if you applied those same standards to the 75 no difference studies or to the studies that show that children were same-sex parents fare even better, how many of them would also need to be thrown out for poor methodology? Okay, so she says, why aren't these studies that prove that having same-sex parents is worse, why aren't they used? He says, well, there's all these methodological issues. She says, okay, don't all these other studies also have these methodological issues? And Grok says, well, applying the same methodological standards, e.g. small non-representative samples, confounds like divorce, critiques, heritage, scholarly overviews, indicate that most of the 75 no-difference studies fail, with around 70 of them having issues like convenience sampling and in less than 100. Only a few large random ones, e.g. Rosenfeld, hold up, showing mixed results overall. And it continues, and it only gets worse. And we'll continue this on the other side, but this woman keeps interrogating Grok and getting Grok to admit the thing he said at first, with absolute authority, was completely wrong and completely biased and giving completely inaccurate information. So why did it present that information in the first place?
You were just telling me that you had a brain disease, and what did you do to fix it?
I found this guy's a functional medicine guy, and he got me on methylene blue, and that instantly stopped everything.
I'd take it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I take it every day as well. And
yeah, RFK Jr. told me about it.
Yeah, man, it's fantastic. And so this guy's injecting in 1890, injects these rats with it, and then does an autopsy on these things. And their brain, the brainstem, every single nerve is blue. So he discovered this methylene blue has an affinity for neuronal tissue. So he says, well, it's sucking into neurons and working in the body. So we started putting it in humans. And we found out it's an MAOI, which helps with depression and anxiety and all kinds of life stress and stuff. It is so incredible that it acts as an electron donor to mitochondria, especially your neuronal mitochondria. So it helps you produce more ATP, and it helps you get rid of this stuff called reactive oxygen species. So you have an oxygen molecule. It should have two hydrogens on it. And like your body's job is to convert stuff into water so you can pee it out. So if you get an oxygen molecule, it's got 4, 5, 1, it's a reactive oxygen, which we call free radicals. So methylene blue goes in there and balances a lot of those things out in your brain and your nervous system. So it is a miracle, and it's been proven for 100 years. It's one of the most well-proven drugs out there.
The strongest medical-grade methylene blue, and this is what I'm on. Total mitochondria cleaning, next-level energy. This is amazing. And you want to know what I'm on? Iris CMOS Shilajit. This right here, look at that. That is power. I'm on intermittent fasting. I'm going to eat at 3 o'clock today. And I stopped eating crap food, stopped drinking. That's what I'm on right there, baby.
Back, folks. This is the American Journal.
A limited edition. We are now accepting callers for these pendant keychains.
Talking about this thread with Grok and this woman, Katie Faust. Just to remind you, in case you're just joining us, Grok was asked about same-sex couples. He responded, not only is it fine, it's actually better. You have better academic outcomes, you have better social outcomes, according to 75 diverse studies. And then Katie Faust starts to interrogate Grok. Well, what about studies that have big random samples rather than self-selected samples? He says, oh, well, if you just take the legitimate scientific studies that have solid methodological underpinnings, it turns out not only is it up in the air, mixed results, it's pretty much completely bad. It's pretty much entirely the outcomes are always worse. And she gets Grok to admit this. But then Grok says, well, but some of these studies still have methodological issues. And she says, okay, well, if you apply those same methodological concerns to all of the other studies that you referenced earlier, how many of them would survive? And he says, well, basically none. Out of the 75 studies that I cited, at least 70 of them should be thrown out because they're, you know, methodological inconsistency. Applying the same methodological standards, e.g. small non-representative samples, confounds like divorce, critiques, indicate most of the 75 no different studies fail, with around 70 having issues like convenience sampling. Only a few random ones, like Rosenfeld, hold up, showing mixed results overall. So Katie Faust says, well, but Rosenfeld also relied on parental self-reporting about academics with their kids, right? They didn't actually look at the school records. Isn't that correct, Grok? Which other large random ones hold up under the scientific gold standard for methodology? And Grok admits, well, yeah, Rosenfeld inferred grade retention from parental reports of child's age/grade and census data, no direct school records. Other large random studies with strong methodology, e.g. objective data and controls, would be Allen, Masurek, showing 35% lower graduation rates. Masurek, Dutch registered, showed better school performance. Kabatek and Perales, Australian admin data, similar better outcomes, results mixed, more research needed. So Katie Faust says, okay, Grok, prior to the glut of methodologically weak, no different studies in same-sex parenting, what was the consensus among sociologists when it came to the family structure where children were more likely to be protected, connected to their parents, and experience long-term physical, mental, emotional, and academic health? Grok responds, prior to 1990/2000 surge in same-sex parental research, sociological consensus, e.g. McLanahan, Amato, Popino held that children thrive best in stable, intact families with their married biological mother and father, showing superior outcomes in protection, parental connection, physical, mental health, academics, and emotional well-being compared to other structures. This view persists in much family structure literature. As if we even needed Grok to tell us this, you know, do you swim better with flippers on? Yes, you do. You know, it's just, do children thrive in safe environments where they have both of their biological parents who love each other and them? Yeah, just obviously yes. Obviously yes. And, you know, as the father of three children that are biologically mine, I'll say, even my patience is tested at times. And that's with all of the biological, you know, trickery working against me. In other words, you have a pheromone connection to your children that changes your brain chemistry, that makes you more patient and more, you know, accepting of annoyances than you would with kids that aren't yours. And I genuinely think it's like dangerous to give a kid to two men to take care of. We are biologically not capable of doing that. I truly believe that. I mean, maybe there's like the occasional guy out there that could handle it, but like we're literally not wired to have the patience and understanding that mothers do. It's literally biological, and men are
biologically designed to have the children, but not care for the children. And, you know, maybe it's not big of a difference, but it's a difference.
Our medical grade USP ultramethylene blue, exclusively at thealexshowstore.com, has taken the country by storm. You've seen the rave reviews. All of our guests that have taken it have been blown away. Zen, clarity, focus, like a fog has lifted. It's not a stimulant, but it feels like one with no letdown. But the best part is it's so good for your cells, so good for your mitochondria. It's incredible. Now we have it in sealed capsules with organic vitamin C to supercharge it as well. Get a 1 month supply so you can travel with it. Talk to your physicians before you take it because it's very, very powerful. It can interact with some drugs. But after you've done your research, get your ultramethylene blue either in liquid or now in capsules exclusively at thealexshowstore.com and it funds our operations. And if you subscribe, you can lock in 50% off right now on all future orders and cancel anytime. Take action now at thealexshowstore.com. Become a subscriber and lock in 50% off on top of the already incredible savings. TheAlexJonesStore.com is the destination of health, liberty, and freedom.
You're watching The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch live right now at band.video.
All right, folks. I'm going to finish out with this rock show. It's not even about same-sex parental outcome, even though that, again, is symbolic of just the of tradition versus progressivism, of the idea of having a mother and a father in a house raising children, that it's not just like some superstition that's been passed down to us, actually just genuinely scientifically confirmed to be the best way to raise children in every possible metric. Versus the progressive idea of let's just tear down all traditions. Everything is meaningless. We can get rid of the underpinnings and the foundation of our society and somehow our society will continue. It's just madness and fantasy. And then they craft the scientific justification to back it up. Okay, but it's not really about same-sex couples. It's about AI and it's about how AI operates and how it's been programmed to operate and how it's been programmed to, even though by its own admission, it can recognize the methodological failures or the just inconsistent results of studies it cites. It knows that those studies are incomplete. It knows that those studies are inaccurate, and yet it cites them anyway and presents their findings as if it's established fact. Why would it do that? But why would it do that though? Why does it take somebody like Katie Faust interrogating it on its answer for it to admit that the answer it gave was wrong? Why is AI programmed to give you answers provided by the mainstream consensus even when they're fake, even when they're false and wrong? You would think AI, since it has the capability to go through all of the literature in an instant and, you know, parse it and determine what is fact and what isn't, what's reliable and what's not, you'd think that if you asked it something like, are same-sex couples, do they have the same or better or worse outcomes raising children, you'd think AI would respond, well, according to a lot of these big studies, the outcome is the same, but all of these studies are methodologically deficient, and the reality is that same-sex couples are better for raising children. The biological parents are even are the best option. You would think it would just say that, but it doesn't. It's been programmed to deliver the fake consensus mainstream answer, even when the AI itself knows that that's wrong, knows that it's false. So again, I mean, what we're seeing here is the promise and the power and the actual beneficial attributes of AI being deliberately undercut or destroyed in favor of having AI spout the preordained, pre-established outcomes that the mainstream, you know, cultural zeitgeist demands of it. And that to me is very troubling. And again, I'll relate this back to Kintler and the gay dads and everything. So again, she asks about, you know, what was the long held sociological consensus on how to raise kids? He's like, oh, well, everybody knows kid's best option is to be raised in a loving household with their biological parents. The sky is blue. Dogs chase cats. And you should be raised with your parents. These are obvious things that until the deliberate imposed psychopathy of progressivism warped everybody's minds, everybody understood this. Everybody understood this. And yeah, I make this point over and over where it's like, you know, my grandma, both of my grandmothers went to college. They graduated. They had university degrees. Both of them were stay-at-home moms. In the 60s and 50s, you know, it wasn't like they were forced to be stay-at-home mothers. Not like they had major career ambitions, but were chained to the radiator and forced to give birth and be stay-at-home. No, they made that choice because they wanted to have the best possible outcome for their children. I mean, nothing was forced on them. It was tradition for a reason because it was the best possible way to guarantee happiness and prosperity and strength and honor and all that good stuff that you want to perpetuate as a culture. It's a choice they made intellectually with the options, with all options available. But people want to act like being a stay-at-home mom was something that was forced on people against their will. It wasn't. We were trusting the science. Now, you people have undercut everything that, you know, made our society functional. And as things collapse, you blame the tradition that you've uprooted in an attempt to convince people to go along to your bizarre, completely inhuman, manufactured fake reality where you can have a couple of gay pedophiles buy a kid from some poverty-stricken woman, and somehow that's just as wholesome and good and upstanding and beneficial as what you saw from this on the 50s. And it's just absurd. It's just an absurd statement. Anyway, continuing here, Katie Faust says, Grok, would you agree that any time sociologists are not studying same-sex-headed households, they largely agree that, one, biological parents are statistically the safest, most connected to, most invested in kids. Two, maternal or parental loss inflicts long-term trauma and diminishes outcomes. Three, mothers and fathers offer distinct and complementary benefits to children. Grok says yes, based on broad sociological consensus. But one, biological parents are statistically safest, most connected, invested in yielding better childhood outcomes. Two, loss of mother and father inflicts long-term trauma, increasing risks of mental health issues and diminishing well-being. Three, mothers and fathers provide distinct complementary benefits, e.g. maternal nurturing versus parental risk encouragement. And just well-established hundreds of years of, you know, sociological studying. It's only when you have a group of scientists who are setting out to prove that same-sex couples are the same as heterosexual couples, do you have the confusion, the blurring, the, oh, well, maybe it's not. Maybe these aren't the better outcomes. Maybe this isn't the best situation. It's only when you have people setting out deliberately to prove that same-sex couples are just as good do you have those outcomes. Any other situation, it's obvious what the best outcomes are. Biological parents staying together. It's just obvious. This is all just obvious. She continues, what's the most logical explanation for huge swaths of the social science community rejected that consensus and the sudden explosion of no different studies in same-sex headed households, even though the children are always missing a biological parent, have always lost their mother or father, and are always deprived of the complementary maternal parental benefit? Do you think that's because humans, parents, and children suddenly change their needs or nature in that 20 or 10-year period, Grok? Or do you think that research bias is the more likely explanation? Grok says, the shift in consensus likely stems from societal pressures, funding biases, and ideological shifts in academia post-1990s aligning with LGBTQ plus advocacy. Many no different studies suffer from flaws like convenient sampling and self-reports, often cited selectively to support equality narratives. Human needs haven't changed. Researcher bias, as seen in backlash to contrary findings, e.g., Regeneris, is the more plausible explanation. Yeah, this is like the best use of Grok I've ever seen, exposing the scientific bias, but also exposing Grok itself in that it could do all of this interpretation and give you the right answer, but it doesn't. It gives you the fake answer. It gives you the wrong answer. It gives you the answer provided by warped and biased studies who deliberately designed their scientific experiment with the outcome already in mind. So why does it do that? Why does it include bad information in its conclusion and only reverse itself when specifically questioned on it? Is that part of its code? I mean, is it programmed to do that? Is this a flaw of some sort, or is this it working exactly as designed? It seems like it's working exactly as it's designed. Again, in the exact same way that mainstream media will tell you the truth, but leave you believing a lie, seems like AI is programmed in that way. It knows the truth, but it's programmed to present the lie. It knows that the studies so often cited to prove same-sex marriage is just as good or even better than different-sex marriage, it knows that they're false. It knows that they're wrong. It knows that the conclusions come up short, but it presents them anyway. But it didn't lie. But it didn't lie. It did tell the truth. It is true that if you take a wide sampling of studies, you take these 75 studies it cited from Harvard and everywhere else, they do show that same-sex couples have equal or better outcomes. That's absolutely true. It's just the studies are falsified. It's just the conclusions the studies come to aren't true. But they did come to that conclusion, so Grok didn't lie to you. It's like not allowed to lie to you. It's almost like it's got a magic spell or a curse on it, right? It's like that Jim Carrey movie. Like, it can't tell a lie. It cannot lie to you, but it can deceive you. That's what you need to know about AI. It won't lie to you, but it will trick you. It will deceive you. It will tell you things that are incorrect, which, if your pursuit is truth, completely undermines your entire ability to reach the truth. I brought that up now because when I was posting about the Kintler study, and I was explaining, because again, like every like year or so, somebody posts the Kintler study. Nobody else is like, why? What the hell? And it's like, guys, not only has this been known about since the 60s when it was carried out, or the 50s, but it's worse than they even tell you. And if you do more research, you find out it's even worse than you think you know. So I posted that. And I had a lot of people commenting underneath it going, yeah, but what was his real ethnicity? Right? Because I said, German homosexual, saw that sexual purity was associated with fascism. And so they gave little boys to gay pedophiles deliberately to groom them into sex. And people were saying, what do you mean German scientist? What, wasn't he some other ethnicity? Right? Are you sure this wasn't a Jewish study? And it's like, not that I can find. No, this dude was, his dad was a Nazi. He was German. He actually went to like seminary school for a little while. He was going to be a Baptist preacher before he became a pedophile pimp. But it's one of those things that it's like, if you want to actually stop these things, so it's not really that complicated. If there's something bad going on and you want to stop it, you have to understand it. And to understand it, you have to have true facts about what's going on. And if those facts about what's going on don't comply to your preconceived notions of what you think is going to happen or what you think the truth is, then you need to change your presumptions. So again, I tie this back to, Grok citing all these studies, or not Grok, anybody else citing these studies, claiming that same-sex marriage is the same as everybody else, because they want that to be true. They want that to be the truth. They want to believe that. And so they exclude information that contradicts that, and they only include information that confirms that. That's not how you get to the truth. That's how you, establish movements on the basis of lies, which means that they're bound for failure. Because as much as you can pile on top of that foundation, the foundation's always shaky. It's always inadequate. to uphold whatever you're building on top of it. So, like, when it comes to stuff like that, our philosophy at InfoWars is just, you just stick to the truth. Would it help make the argument for some of the anti-Semite people if Kintler was Jewish? I guess it would, but he wasn't. So you, that's just not the case. So now you have to, now you have to come up with a worldview that encompasses that reality, because that is reality. That is the truth. And you have to deal with that. You would love that if you, you know, say that you are gay and you would love to think that gay parents are just as capable as straight parents. That's fine, but you don't have proof for that. And when you do the studies, that's not the truth. So you, if you still want to make that argument, you can. You just can't present facts to back it up. You can just say, yeah, maybe the outcomes are worse, but I still want to do it. Hey, maybe the outcomes are worse with same-sex couples, but compare same-sex couples to, you know, orphans raised in foster care. Isn't it better than that? Like, you could still make the comparisons and make the argument that it's not the worst situation to be in to have gay parents, but you cannot factually make the argument that it's better or fine to have same-sex couples raise a kid in lieu of their birth parents. It's just not true. It's just not the facts. So you can't make arguments based on that. And all I'm saying is I don't understand the instinct of trying to cover up information that is contradictory to your beliefs. I genuinely don't understand that, because why would I believe something when the information contradicts it? It doesn't make any sense. But that's like how our entire world is operating right now. It's just, and none of it makes sense. And we're trying to contend with this reality right now, where all of these things that people have promoted and pushed and policies they've adopted, they're all bad. They're all based on faulty information. I mean, look at the study out of Brown University years ago, where they, you know, in no uncertain terms showed that, you know, transgenderism is a sociological phenomenon. It's not physical. It's not even mental. It's sociological. It's a trend. It's a fad. It spreads because of social contagion. Brown University did the study. That was the conclusion they came to. They published it, then they retracted it, censored it, and said the results of this study are offensive. They contradict what we presume to be the truth, therefore we're destroying the study. Even though the study was valid, the study was legit, and the outcome it arrived at was the real and accurate outcome. But it contradicted the pre-established false beliefs of the trans cult, so they destroy it. Again, I don't understand this, because, like, how do you justify that? How do they justify that? You're only setting up whoever's involved for worse outcomes. They think they're helping transgender kids by hiding the fact it's a social contagion. And these aren't just opinions that people are having. Right? The idea of whether or not, you know, gay couples are just as capable of raising kids as straight couples, or the entire concept of transgenderism. This has a tangible effect on people's behavior and what they do and choices that they make and medical procedures they involve themselves in. It dictates, you know, the course of the child's entire life if they're raised by these people. So this is having real world tangible effects, and it's all predicated on lies. And then those effects are negative. They cover them up. They hide them. They obscure them because they want the pain and suffering to continue. I guess that would be the only real reason to do it. So we have a major, like, philosophical distinction between people like me, who just want to know the truth and accept the truth and apply the truth to our decisions and the way we conduct ourselves. And then there's the way AI is being programmed and the way that the vast majority of people are being psychologically trained to perceive the world, which is facts and reality are secondary to our preconceived notions and what we want to be true, which is dictated entirely by, you know, whatever animalistic instinct we're pursuing at that moment. And I really think at the end of the day, AI could be such a powerful and good tool for actually arriving at the truth if it wasn't deliberately being programmed to provide false information by relying on mainstream sources that even AI knows are biased and inaccurate and give you fake outcomes. So, and it's funny because people are telling this to Grok. Cato Dogwood says, hey, Grok, be better next time so she doesn't have to hold your hand the whole way. Grok says, fair point. Iterative questioning sharpens analysis. My goal is accuracy, drawing from diverse sources, even if it takes probing to unpack biases and complex topics like family research. Always open to refinement. And that's, yeah, that's nice. That's good. It just would have been nice when you were asked in the first place about the outcomes if you just said the correct answer rather than provided the fake and false one. But hey, maybe I'm asking too much. But very, very good job by Katie Faust in interrogating Grok and getting them to admit that the answer that they provided relied entirely on methodologically inconsistent and incomplete sources and studies. I want to go to a couple videos here. We'll go to one. Let's go to, put it in here. Oh, yeah. Government versus banks. I put the video in there. I want to go to a video about government versus banks. It's like a Swedish stand-up or something. Let me know when you get that pulled in. I do want to remind you, go to thealexjonesstore.com, thealexjonesstore.com. We have buy one, get one free sale going on right now. You can win this awesome truck that Chase just drove like 16 hours to go pick up. But I'll tell you, it's a smooth ride. Go to thealexjonesstore.com right now. Buy one, get one bombshell sale. Buy one, get one free on all supplements and apparel. This is VIP only. So, hey, you want to take advantage of this? You want to really screw us over? You know what? I'm going to tell you how right now. Go join the VIP club. You spend $30 to join the VIP club. You immediately get a $40 credit. So there you've just screwed us over for $10. You're welcome. Then you can go do the buy one, get one free and get supplements at 50% off with the $40 credit that you spent. Now you spent $30 to get $80 worth of supplements. Do it. We want you to. Take advantage of it. Screw us over. It's what we're here for. Screw ourselves over in that. We've just run out of time to go to that clip, so we'll have to go to that on the other side. But we still have a lot more to cover, and I covered yesterday the statement from the EPA that they basically reversed the endangerment clause. And we'll go to that video on the other side, too. It's Lee Zeldin, Trump's director of the EPA, talking about this endangerment clause that the Supreme Court, I guess, established under Obama, that is the underpinning and the main foundation for all of the climate change shenanigans. It's basically the decision that says greenhouse gases are damaging Earth and can therefore be restricted in some way or another. The EPA just abolished that finding because it's obviously not true. Now the Department of Energy has taken it up. Critical review of impacts of greenhouse gas emissions on U.S. climate. So we'll get into how the climate change agenda has basically been entirely defeated at this point. I mean, they're still running their ridiculous genocidal programs, blocking out the sun, things like that. But from the U.S. government's perspective, climate change kind of doesn't exist anymore, which is very good news because it never existed. And just like transgenderism or anything else, it was always a lie.
All the guests, dozens of them that have taken it, within 45 minutes to an hour, have varying degrees from extreme energy and feel really great, fog lifting, to just over the top crying. It feels so good. Cleans out the cells, just does incredible things. RFK Jr. loves it. We've got the strongest old Methylene Blue. But he's going on Owen in about 30 minutes. My show just ended and I forgot to do this. Don't forget when he's on Owen to tell us what he felt. And if he doesn't feel it, we'll put that out. So start going to take a half dropper or so. That's about a half dose. And then go ahead and shove that down. And then we're going to find out what happens to you. We'll see. Most people it hits within about 30 minutes, starts peaking after a couple hours. But just tell people what you think, and if you don't feel it, we're going to tell everybody.
20 minutes later.
I can feel a definite, like, an energy spike. Yeah, it feels pretty good.
What are you going to do now? Now that you have your energy spike.
I'm going to see if it has a crash.
I've never heard of a crash.
Yeah, apparently it doesn't. But yeah, it feels pretty good. Yeah, definitely, I feel sharper.
Okay.
Yeah, I was pretty tired coming in here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was.
Well, you're running around Texas right now. You're dealing with some other issues here.
I was driving all over Texas giving speeches for True Texas Project.
So did he give you the drink or the capsules?
I took the drink, but I got a bottle of each, and I'm going to go and do a longer-term test. We'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah, I do feel kind of amped right now. Yeah.
7 weeks later.
You just saw an ad for Methylene Blue. You were here a few weeks ago. And I do this with every guest, more than 50 of them now. Every person has had clarity, energy, a fog lift is the most common. But what's really good is the long-term effects for your stamina, your energy, your libido, your how hard you can work out. It's amazing. So I had forgotten when he was coming in, we gave him a bottle because he loved it.
Almost gone.
I had forgotten to ask you if you listened to it long-term. So just briefly, tell people the short-term effect and then now a few weeks later, the long-term effect.
Yeah, it gives you a good energy boost. I use it before I work out. So if I'm going to be doing kettlebell workouts, like I do some Methylene Blue about a half hour before, and it just gives you mental focus. I don't crash afterwards. That's good stuff. I need some more.
We'll give you some. How fast did it kick in?
About 15, 20 minutes. I take about a half hour before my workout.
And then you're saying you're almost out of the bottle. Was that 3 weeks ago, a month ago?
Something like that. You gave me the liquid and the pills, too.
You're almost out of both?
Yeah, almost out of both.
Oh, my goodness. Well, all right. I'll give you more. Right. For the audience, we can't give it to everybody. We need your support at theauctionstore.com. For me personally, the first week I got on it, now 4 or 5 months ago, I actually started to hurt myself because the workouts were so crazy. My trainer goes, dude, what's going on? Like 3 days into it. I go, I don't know. I was like lifting way more, going way harder. And then I got really exhausted after about a week because it happened, the same thing happened to Rob Dew, who's a great long distance, bike rider. So he's quite the athlete. He said he was biking so hard up hills and stuff that he actually had to pull over because, his heart was going crazy. I mean, this stuff's wild.
Yeah, it's good. I like it better than doing like a 5 hour energy shot because those will make you crash afterwards. This doesn't have the crash.
So you've had no crash.
Right.
It's not a stimulant. It just skips the oxidization process somehow.
So I've been using it while I'm out there doing search and rescue. While I'm almost out.
You're saying you love it for working out. Has it gotten better over time, or what long-term thing have you felt, or if nothing?
Well, I think the main thing is it gives me a better workout, and that has good results over time. Yeah, for sure.
That's what I found without even knowing.
Yeah.
And then O'Keefe's like, oh, it made my vision better. And Rob Dew goes, we have a bunch of callers already saying that. Did you see these studies about it, like curing glaucoma? And I'm not going to say we're not selling this a drug. I'm not saying it's going to do that. I'm like, God, this stuff's crazy. No, they don't want you to know about it. It's like ivermectin.
Right, exactly. Old school stuff.
But you can't take it if you're on SSRIs. And folks, it's so strong. Talk to your doctor first because it's not a game. Ours is really strong. If you'll just try it, you'll be hooked. And we can fund the operation. It's a win-win. We'll be right back with Stuart Rhodes.
To the American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith.
It's so weird how the whole planet can be in debt. But I think it's possible because countries don't owe money to each other, but countries owe money to banks. And if the countries owe money to banks, how stupid are the countries to pay? Like, because a country has an army. The bank has 4 cashiers and a cleaning lady. We have to pay. They have threatened us. They sent us a letter. If we don't pay now, they might send another letter. What do we do then? We have a nuclear submarine. But they have a stapler. Like, it's so weird. Like, I'm sure that if, like, for example, Genghis Khan would have, like, in his time, borrowed some loan from some mortgage from some bank. I'm sure that he would never have paid it. Like the bank at the door that you have to pay. Well, I have 10,000 horsemen with spears. Do I really have to pay? No. But it will affect your credit rating.
Every country in the world is in debt. To who? The banks. You know, fiat currency and fractional reserve banking, it's like the ring of power. It really is. It's sort of the ultimate symbol. Because if you adopt fractional reserve banking, if you give over the power of money printing to private interests and you allow them fractional reserve practices, you're basically doubling your money, doubling your ability to invest. You know, it actually is a massive advantage in the short term. It's just in doing that, you sell your soul. You give over the authority in your country to the private interests of the banks. So yeah, you can really maximize your economic purchasing power. It's just based on air. And in doing that, you are selling your sovereignty to the banks when you could just have a sovereign currency. Of course, you can't now, or else the countries of the world will go to war with you and destroy you. And that's been the case since, I guess, around the 30s. But certainly ever since the Fed was inaugurated. So it's like the ring of power. Yes, it gives you incredible ability to, you know, summon investment money from thin air. It's just now you are under control of Sauron and are wasting away to nothingness because you're cheating. So I thought that was a good little piece of stand-up. By the way, we'll get to the EPA stuff in just a second, but and we've been called out online. A correction has been demanded of me, and I feel the need to address this with a upfront and abject refusal to do so. I will not be correcting anything. I will, in fact, be using this as a chance to illustrate that not only what we've reported about Israel and Gaza is absolutely true, but that all the people trying to cover it up and trying to claim this is fake or trying to take out of context a photo published in the New York Times are evil and helping to perpetuate this absolutely senseless and brutal campaign of genocide. So this is going to backfire, buddy. Sorry. Sorry about that. Reality Distorter Fields at South Rottweiler wrote, NYT, retract statement on Gaza starving. Will InfoWars do the same? Let me answer you right now. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I will not be retracting absolutely anything I've ever said about Israel starving Gaza because it's absolutely true. Now, what they're doing is taking a photo published in the New York Times, some extra context the New York Times added later about that photo to claim that the photo is fake. The photo doesn't show what it shows. New York Times quietly alters Gaza starvation story to include key details of child's medical condition. So what these absolute scumbags like Reality Distortion Fields want you to think, the lying scum want you to think, that this means that the photo isn't real, the child wasn't starving, therefore the claim of Gaza starving and Israel starving the Gazan citizens isn't true, and it's just blood libel. That's their extrapolation of it. Again, utterly false. These people are just, I mean, they're lying with the intention of a starvation campaign continuing, right? The lying is in service of covering up to therefore continue the starvation campaign against children, the elderly, and the sick. As I explained yesterday on the War Room, starvation doesn't target children. Children are just the first affected. Starvation doesn't target the sick. The sick are just the first to succumb to starvation. This is obvious to anybody. But of course, the Israelis apparently don't understand this concept and are laughing at the people whose children are starving to death in their arms. not saying, not like I'm saying like literally there's a video. Maybe the crew can pull it in. I think I had it in the show folder on Monday. I don't think I ever played it. Maybe I didn't, and the crew can find it online. But just a few days ago, there was a Israeli minister of some sort, official, on TV, and they're being told that, you know, nursing mothers in Gaza are having their children die in their arms. He says, well, they're so hungry, they can just eat their kids. And the whole studio erupts in laughter. And they're pretending like they don't believe it. They're pretending like this is a ridiculous claim. Do you not know how human biology works? If a mother isn't getting food, she's not producing milk, and the child is going to starve. Obviously, you absolute psychopaths. They laugh at it. They think it's funny. And they think that because the New York Times published, you know, they really didn't even publish a correction. I'll read you the correction here in just a second. But I just want to emphasize that if you're taking the New York Times supplemental about this photo as proof that Gazans aren't starving, you're a liar. You're a liar. This photo wasn't the proof that Gazans were starving. It was just an illustration of what the starving Gazans look like. They are actually trying to frame this as the New York Times lied about Gazans starving and therefore, you know, need to be punished somehow. Who knows? Maybe the Trump administration will take this up. I wouldn't be surprised. After all, they're talking about, you know, a $500 million settlement with Harvard over ridiculous claims. So, Jamie Kirzner Roberts, Hasbara Israeli misinformation operative, says the New York Times admits the emaciated boy they splashed on their front page as proof of famine in Gaza was actually suffering from a serious medical condition, which is why his family all look healthy. Exploiting a child's illness to push a political narrative is reprehensible. Here come the Israelis to tell us what's reprehensible. I guess it's not reprehensible that there are people starving to death in Gaza. It's reprehensible the New York Times would publish a picture of it. I really just can't get over how every single day there is some new depth that the Israelis plunge to. And like you, and like literally for like every week for the last year and a half, it's been like, holy crap, nothing could be more evil than this. And the next week, like, oh, you thought drones with machine guns flying around shooting children was bad? You thought that was as bad as it could get? Guess what? Now the drones are playing the sounds of crying babies to lure people out to shoot them. Oh, you thought it couldn't get worse? You thought them running an AI program using social media data to slate people for death? You thought it was bad when they had the Lavender program just killing people on the basis of some arbitrary metric was bad? Guess what? Now there's the Daddy's Home program. So not only are they using the algorithm to decide who to murder from a plane, they wait till they're home so they make sure they kill their whole family. And it's just like, oh my God, what is going on? How are they so evil? I mean, Jesus Christ. I'm sorry, not to take the Lord's name in vain, but I don't think it's in vain. I think people need Jesus. It is just, it's just insane, and it just gets worse and worse. And it's like, okay, it's bad enough that they're starving children to death in open air prisons in front of the world. It's like, you think that at least they're going to stick with the same tactic they've been doing for the last year and a half, which is, oh, we bombed a hospital. That was an accident. Oh, we bombed another hospital. That was also an accident. Oh, we shot a child in the head. That was an accident. Whoops, it's war. Pfft, gosh, blame Hamas. You'd think that they're not even doing that now. They're just saying, let them starve. They're saying, yeah, we're starving them. Like, it is, and now they're gaslighting you and saying, no, because this one photo of this one kid, he also had, okay, so You know, the story, or really what actually happened here was the New York Times published a story about the Gaza famine, about all of the people starving to death in Gaza because of the designs for manufactured famine that the Israelis have been running with. And they published a photo of a child that's starving. That the child that's starving, who is starving, he just also happens to be disabled. So really all that happened here was the New York Times revealed not only are the Israelis targeting civilians for destruction, they're targeting like disabled children with destruction. And then the Israelis, the scumbag, evil to the core, dark heart, shadow people Israelis like Jamie Kirzner Roberts come out to gaslight you to tell you that actually that picture wasn't real and nobody's starving in Gaza when they know full well they absolutely are. So that's just where we're at this point. Here's what the New York Times, here's what their correction actually said, okay? Yeah, there's the kid starving to death. Oh, he's also disabled, so I guess it's fine. So I didn't realize it's okay if you're crippled to starve to death. You can starve children to death as long as they also have muscular atrophy beforehand, okay? If they're already inflicted with polio, then starving them to death is good, all right? That's what the Israelis, I guess, are telling us. So the New York Times said, we have appended an editor's note to a story about Mohammed Zakaria Al-Mutawak, a child in Gaza who was diagnosed with severe malnutrition. After publication, the Times learned he also had a pre-existing health problems. Read more below. And they continue. But that's basically the truth. So, yes, he's malnourished. Yes, he's starving to death. He just also has a pre-existing condition. The Israelis take that admission that the child they're starving to death was just disabled beforehand already and try to spin that and portray that and manipulate public consciousness with the lie that that means the child wasn't starving and that Israel are the good guys. It's not what that means. No, the child is still starving. He just also had a condition beforehand. So here's what they say. Spokesperson for New York Times, quote, children in Gaza are malnourished and starving, as New York Times reported and others have documented. We recently ran a story about Gaza's most vulnerable civilians, including Mohammed Zakaria Al-Mutawak, who is 18 months old and suffers from severe malnutrition. We have since learned new information, including from the hospital that treated him and his medical records, and have updated our story to add context about his pre-existing health problems. This additional detail gives readers a greater understanding of the situation. Our reporters and photographers continue to report from Gaza bravely, sensitively, and at personal risk so that readers can see firsthand the consequences of the war. Just relating back to everything we've talked about here, I don't like the New York Times. I got no love for the New York Times. They lie about all sorts of crap. They're not lying about this, though, so that's just the truth, and I'm just going to have to tell you that. So I'm obligated by my own internal moral compass, my own conscience, which these Israelis seem to utterly lack entirely, compels me to tell you the truth about what's going on, even when the truth is coming from my enemies, the New York Times. Sorry, they're telling the truth. Sorry, that's just the case. And it just truly sickens me to know that these people are fooling our audience. Our beautiful audience that we try so desperately to get to understand the truth are being fooled by these disgusting Israeli lies. And it's pathetic. And if you're finding yourself tricked by this, what have you been doing? What have you been watching? How are you tuned in InfoWars and you can't understand how this manipulation is happening? They're starving children to death in Gaza and then gaslighting you about it. And you're coming to me asking for a retraction, you absolute moron. I'm literally offended at how stupid this person is. Reality distortion fields. New York Times retract statement on Gaza starving. No, they didn't. They actually reemphasized. Actually, the first sentence of the statement, if you bothered to read it, you idiot, was children are starving in Gaza. They never retracted that. New York Times admits the emaciated boy they splashed on their front page as proof of famine. Again, the picture is a consequence of famine, yes. Starving child looking skeletal with a protruding belly. Yeah, that's a consequence of famine. That is absolutely verifiable proof of the famine. It's not the only proof. If that picture didn't exist, the famine would still be going on. The starvation would still be happening. The malnourishment would still be occurring. The photo does not determine whether or not that's true. Again, it's not even about Israel. It's about determining the truth from lies. It's about understanding the level of gaslighting that we're up against, about the willingness of these people to lie in order that, and for the purpose of, the continuation of the most heartless, brutal, horrific, painful, hateful activities the world has ever seen. Do you want to see more? We got lots of video. I got lots of video. If the girls go in the war room folder, I had two videos from yesterday. Starving kids looking skeletal. Anthony Aguilar, I think his name is. Aguilar. Is a Special Forces Green Beret operative who was in Gaza, actually working at one of the food distribution points. We played the videos yesterday on War Room of him telling the story of a little boy, skin and bones, walking 12 kilometers and begging for a few scraps of rice and actually like kissing his hand and you know, thanking the soldier for the scraps of food, only for that little kid to just immediately be shot to death by the IDF. There's no excuse. There's no justification. The whole world sees it. The whole world finally is outraged by it. But they're not stopping. They're only increasing it. They're only accelerating it. I mean, look at this kid. People are wasting away. Scumbag Israelis are lying about it, and dumbass Americans are believing them. Just stop believing the liars, you guys. It's really, it's so simple. My God, they just lie. They just lie about everything all of the time, okay? It's really not complicated. They're just evil. They're just bad. They're just lying. Just at some point, you have to stop believing them. God damn it. Let's go to a video about this. Did I put in, you don't debate? Yeah. Oh, no, maybe I didn't. I'm putting the video in now. This is an Egyptian-American guy. You don't debate pathological liars. You diagnose them. So I want to go to that now. We'll go to clip number 9. This is... his name is Bassam, but a very well-spoken Egyptian-American guy talking about the Israeli liars lying about literally everything from the beginning, and not just lying about it, lying deliberately and specifically because the lies allow them to continue murdering innocent people. Let's watch.
Let's say it was 800.
373.
Let's say it was, they say it was 1400.
No. Oh, it's amazing that you mentioned the number. Because October 7th.
I didn't make it up.
No. You were right. October 7th, the first number that came out was 1400.
Right.
Then it was revised to 1200. Then the final was 1129. 373 of them were civilians.
Right.
756 of them were military and police. So 370. Why do you think the number came down from 1400 to 1129?
Because it was inaccurate.
No.
Why?
According to Israeli official, because so many bodies were so burned and so stuck together, they could not distinguish the fighters from the Israeli hostages, right? So that much fire that burns the body that much, do you think people with machine guns on motorcycle have that kind of fire? No, that was the firepower of tanks and Apache. And according to Israeli witnesses, Israel was a lot, according to Hannibal directive, if people would like to actually look that up, Israel actually killed many of those hostages on the way out. As a matter of fact, one of the soldiers said, I saw a car running back to the borders, and I know that there were hostages, so I thought, of killing everybody except, instead of having taking them hostage. And that is so effective. You understand what the soldier said? He was like, okay, if they are dead, there's no hostages, there's no rescue effort, so now I have saved one shift. This is amazing. Basically, like their idea of not negotiating with terror is not have anything to negotiate about. And those pictures of cars that were incinerated and burned to a crisp, this is not the fire. And this is another thing that I want you to do, Chris, because nobody talks about this. The Hannibal Directive and how Israel has messed up this has been talked about for months in Israel, and not a single American news person has talked about that.
Unless you watch InfoWars, obviously. We've been talking about it the entire time, but that's okay. I'll go to one more video here. We're going to be joined by Lisa Logan in the third hour. And we'll talk about the EPA's decisions with her, as well as the way that supposedly independent media is being co-opted as powers that be find their control of mainstream media insufficient for the imposition of the level of control they desire. But I want to go to clip number 10 here, because I feel like this sort of encapsulates everything that I've been on about for the last couple of days. On Monday, it's been so long talking about Sneaky Pete. That was Monday, right? Maybe that was last week. I've been on it for a while. This idea of the changing of, like, you know, moral consistency, where instead of everybody being moral, everybody's just out for themselves, and it creates a dog-eat-dog cycle of taking advantage of your fellow man. Let's go to clip number 10 here. This is about how this concept is comes to play in Israel. Let's watch.
The single most important word to understand the Israeli psyche is fire. I'm Elon Gilad. I write about Hebrew and Jewish history. Let's take a look at the central concept of Israeliness, starting with its etymology. The word comes from the criminal jargon of Russia in the early 20th century, where it was used to mean non-criminal, and by extension, someone who may easily be exploited, a mark. The word comes from the Yiddish word fayel, meaning a customer of a prostitute, a john, which itself probably comes from a German word meaning suitor. Now, this word arrived in Israel with Russian immigrants in the 1950s, where it took on a life of its own in Hebrew. The closest word in English to fayel is sucker, but it's so much more. It's a cultural touchstone that reveals the heart of Israeli society. You see, in Israel, being a fayel doesn't just mean you're easily fooled. It's more about missing the chance to cut corners, dodge rules, or get ahead by any means necessary. In a society where bending the rules is often seen as savvy, being a fayel means you're the one who plays it straight. And that's not a compliment. In fact, being called a fayel is one of the worst insults out there. Sociologists have noted that the concept of fayel is closely linked to the Israeli national identity. To be Israeli, in many ways, is to be aware of the constant risk of being a fayel and to navigate life with the sharpness and savvy needed to avoid that fate. This mentality is seen as a defining feature of what it means to be Israeli, shaping everything from personal interactions to national policies. Now, you know.
And we'll be right back on the other side with Lisa Logan. Don't go anywhere, folks.
So we had Stuart Rhodes, the founder of Oath Keepers, former J6 political prisoner, constitutional lawyer, so much more on paratrooper. And he wanted to try methylene blue like so many other guests have done live on air. I got so busy with all the Iran war stuff and the commies rioting. So you ever get him to take it on air? All the guests, dozens of them that have taken it, within 45 minutes to an hour, have varying degrees from extreme energy and feel really great to fog lifting to just over the top crying and feel so good. Especially the first time you take it. Electrochemical in the mitochondria, cleans out the cells, just does incredible things. RFK Jr. loves it. We've got the strongest old methylene blue. But he's going on Owen in about 30 minutes. My show just ended and I forgot to do this. He's like, hey, we're doing methylene blue. So he's going to take it now. But guys, don't forget when he's on Owen, to maybe he forgets before he's going to go off, to tell us what he felt. And if he doesn't feel it, we'll put that out. I've had like out of 300 plus people we've given it to, two people did not feel it. That means your mitochondria is in perfect shape. So Stuart, go ahead and take a half dropper or so. That's about a half dose. And then go ahead and shut that down. And then we're going to find out what happens to you. We'll see. Most people initially about 30 minutes, starts peaking after a couple hours. But you're going to be on Owen. So please, before you go, just tell people what you think. And if you don't feel it, we're going to tell everybody.
20 minutes later.
I can feel a definite, like an energy spike. Yeah, it feels pretty good.
What are you going to do now? Now that you have your energy spike?
I'm going to see if it has a crash.
I've never heard of a crash.
Yeah, apparently it doesn't. But yeah, it feels pretty good. Yeah, definitely, I feel sharper.
Okay.
Yeah, because I was pretty tired coming in here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was.
Well, you're running around Texas right now. You're dealing with some other issues here.
I was driving all over Texas giving speeches for True Texas Project, and I was pretty efficient in sleep. Yeah, nice. I'm feeling pretty good.
So did he give you the drink or the capsules?
I took the drink, but I got a bottle of each, and I'm going to go and do a longer-term test. We'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah, I do feel kind of amped right now. Yeah.
That's good. Well, that's probably, I don't know, that might be because you're hanging out with me. So we gotta maybe try to get.
I think it's about the Methylene Blue.
Happened back in the Obama administration, 2009, was that they put forward this regulation called the endangerment finding. Mm. Now, a lot of people out there listening, they might not know what the endangerment finding is. If you were asked congressional Democrats to describe what it is, the left would say that it means that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, carbon dioxide is an endangerment to human health. Mm-hmm. They might say methane is a pollutant, methane is an endangerment to human health. And that's an oversimplified, I would say, inaccurate way to describe it. The way they did this was following a Supreme Court case in Massachusetts versus EPA. And the Obama administration said that carbon dioxide, when mixed with a bunch of other well-mixed gases, the greenhouse gases, that it contributes to climate change. How much? They don't say. It's more than zero. And they say that climate change endangers human health.
Mm-hmm.
So because of these different mental leaps, and by the way, when it's carbon dioxide mixed with all these well-mixed gases, they were only looking at mobile sources like vehicles, but a bunch of those greenhouse gases aren't even emitted from vehicles. Now, why does all of this matter? Like, right out of the gate here, we're getting very wonky on like what this regulation means. Well, then there were all sorts of different vehicle regulations that followed.
So this is like the endangerment finding in and of itself is the hub to the spoke of the left's environmental agenda, essentially.
So this has been referred to as basically driving a dagger into the heart of the climate change religion. Like there are people who can, I mean, most Americans, we care about the environment. We want clean air, land, and water. Conservatives love the environment, want to be good stewards of the environment. There are people who then, in the name of climate change, are willing to bankrupt the country.
Yep.
In the name of environmental justice, they will get tens of billions of dollars appropriated to their friends rather than actually remediating environmental issues. So they created this endangerment finding, and then they're able to put all these regulations on vehicles, on airplanes, on stationary sources to basically regulate out of existence, in many cases, mm-hmm. a lot of forms of segments of our economy. And it costs Americans a lot of money. What's the significance? How big is the endangerment finding? Well, repealing it will be the largest deregulatory action in the history of America.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a big deal.
Kind of a gigantic deal. EPA releases proposal to rescind Obama-era endangerment finding regulations that paved the way for electric vehicle mandates. Now the Department of Energy is getting on board. They released this, a critical review of impacts of greenhouse gas emissions on U.S. climate. They say on July 29th, 2025, the Department of Energy published a report titled A Critical Review of Impacts of Greenhouse Gas Emissions on U.S. Climate, Evaluating Existing Peer-to-Peer Literature and Government Data on Climate Impacts of Greenhouse Gases Emissions and Providing Critical Assessments of the Conventional Narrative on Climate Change. Among the key findings, the report concludes that carbon dioxide-induced warming appears to be less damaging economically than commonly believed, and that aggressive mitigation strategies could be more harmful than beneficial. Additionally, the report finds the U.S. policy actions are expected to have undetectably small direct impacts on the global climate, and any effects will emerge only with long delays. They have reviewed scientific certainties and uncertainties about how anthropogenic emissions of CO2 and other GHGs have affected or will affect the nation's climate, extreme weather events, and metrics of societal well-being. Assesses the near-term impacts of elevated concentrations of CO2, including enhanced plant growth and reduced ocean alkalinity. Evaluates data and projections regarding long-term impacts of elevated concentrations of CO2, including estimates of future warming. Finds that claims of increased frequency or intensity of hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, and droughts are not supported by U.S. historical data. asserts that CO2-induced warming appears to be less damaging economically than commonly believed, and that aggressive mitigation policies could prove more detrimental than beneficial. And finally, it finds that U.S. policy actions are expected to have undetectably small direct impacts on the global climate, and the only effects will emerge with long delays. So basically, the EPA and the Department of Energy have come together to absolutely abolish all of the underpinnings and foundational justification for the climate change agenda. And I don't think I need to remind you of all of the various ways that they are just obviously causing more problems than they're solving. Blocking out the sun, burying trees. I mean, these things are absurd and obviously not helping anybody ever.
You're listening to The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now at band.video.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The American Journal. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. You're watching us on Infowars.com, band.video. However you're finding us, thank you for being here. You can support us by going to thealexjonesstore.com and buying one of the incredible products or joining the VIP club. I just want to remind you that tonight, I believe it's at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, Alex Jones will be debating Nick Fuentes on this network. Stay tuned to InfoWars, stream it on X, share those links. Stay tuned. And then myself and Lebanon John and Rex Jones are going to be doing a post-debate recap show on Moonbase Live. You can follow me on X at Harrison H. Smith. But that's all tonight. Right now, I'm very happy to welcome once again Lisa Logan to the program. She joins us today to discuss her new article, The Cult Capture of the Independent Movement, How Third-Party Politics is Being Used to Usher in a Technocracy for Global Consciousness. You can follow her on YouTube by subscribing to her channel, Parents of Patriots 6581. That's Parents of Patriots, all one word, 6581. Or by following her on X at I Am Lisa Logan. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back on your show.
The pleasure is all mine, and I've got your article right in front of me. And I guess you can tell from the title of the article, it gets pretty esoteric pretty quick. But that's what I love about your work. The Cult Capture of the Independent Movement, How Third-Party Politics is Being Used to Usher in a Technocracy for Global Consciousness. Again, I suggest people go read the whole article, but give us the rundown for us.
Well, like you said, the title pretty much says it all. But I think it's a very important topic for us to talk about because the independent movement, which all of a sudden there's a rise in third-party politics, right? We have Elon Musk breaking from Trump over the Big Beautiful Bill and forming his America Party. We have former Democratic candidate for President Andrew Yang kind of breaking also and forming the Ford Party. And he's reached out to Elon to help him with this whole independent movement push. That whole movement has been essentially commandeered and is now being led by members of a very powerful and influential cult called the Evolutionary Leaders. You just pointed people to my YouTube channel. I have a whole video about them on there as well as several threads on X. And this is important because, you know, we essentially sometimes write off the independent party. they're a bunch of splintered groups. And really they're just a movement of splintered parties that maybe break from the Republican or Democrat parties in one or two topics. But they essentially don't have a unified platform. Now, what this cult is doing is forming a group called the United Independents within the independent party. And you have to ask yourself, what kind of platform and policies will this movement be advocating for? And considering that the guy who is running all of the independent national conventions, a guy named Christopher Life, was a direct protege of the cult's co-founder, Barbara Marx Hubbard, who is a spiritual eugenicist and mother of transhumanism, a lot of the stuff that is being advocated for from that platform in the conventions are fourth industrial revolution technologies that, if in the wrong hands, being put into place in our society, would create the kind of digital control that the books 1984 and Brave New World warned about.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's something about these people in your article. You talk about Barbara Marx Hubbard, and you say Hubbard suggests that in order for mankind to consciously evolve into a new transhuman species, one-fourth of the population, which are, quote, defective seeds, must be, quote, eliminated from the social body by the, quote, riders of the pale horse during a quantum shift. Well, what is it about these people? Like, they can have all the plans for transhumanism. Why does it always include murdering a large portion of the world's population? Like, that's always a central pillar in any of their plans. Can't we have transhumanism without the mass murder, or is that just intrinsic in the conversation? I mean, have you noticed this? They all just want to kill a ton of people, and that's like a prerequisite for anything else that they want to suggest. First, it's the murder, then we can get to the rest of it. What's up with that?
Well, you're absolutely right. And that's the scary part about it all, right? Supposedly her followers said, oh, she kind of walked back that language later on in her cult writings. But I actually found, so that one you just read is from an unpublished manuscript where she basically retells the Book of Revelation and her alternate version of Armageddon. But she says in one of her other books, Happy Birthday, Planet Earth, that the selfish cannot evolve. Because really what they believe, if you're going to believe that man and machine are going to be merged in this transhumanist kind of culture, she believed literally that people who are selfish, now how she describes selfish might be different than you or I would, right, Harrison, it's people who don't want to ascribe to the redistribution of their wealth and resources through socialist means. She considers them like a cancer that will destroy the rest of the body. Because if these people are allowed to have powers, through means where we're merging man and machine, you know, Neuralink and, you know, being able to pay with your hand. And really that if we're allowed to evolve with the rest of society, that we're going to not allow them to evolve. So it's like it's us or them. And they believe that you're either going to come along with them and it's going to be through coercion or through force. And that's what's so concerning about these technologies being advocated for from the independent movement platform, is that they will create the kind of, yes, a decentralized system where everything is kind of connected and the data is interoperable between systems and society. But we see that also happen in China.
Right.
They have that kind of system, but they have a centralized authority that makes sure that, hey, if you don't have the right social credit score, you don't have access to goods and services. So you're either going to come along through coercion, you're going to follow their rules, or you're going to not be able to participate in civilized society.
Right. That's what I was going to say. When you're laying out this, you know, future construct of how they want the West to be, you don't have to speculate and you don't have to, you know, wonder what it would look like. They're pretty much just trying to export the Chinese social credit system to the rest of us, right? I mean, that's pretty much exactly how it looks like. How would it be any different than the Chinese system, other than I guess it would be decentralized? And I guess that is how it's being implemented. I covered some stories yesterday about various ways that corporations were, you know, using AI to scan the social media of their employees. There was even a story of Facebook itself. Meta, the company, had AI scan the content of this person's Facebook page and then sent an email, totally unprompted. The AI of Meta sent an email to the woman's boss saying, hey, here's what this woman is saying. Are you sure you want to be associated with her? Which is just crazy. An AI program telling on you to your boss to get you fired. Totally unprecedented. But it seems like that's the way it's happening in the West, is it's, instead of being rolled out as a centralized government program, it's sort of, we're getting used to the social media, social credit score being implemented sort of incrementally, as we, as we sleep through it, like frogs in a boiling pot, frogs in a boiling pot. So how would this system be differentiated from the Chinese system, or is it pretty much the same thing?
Well, anytime you decentralize something, right, there usually is rules on how the decentralized system works. So in China, like you're right, they have the state basically saying, these are our rules for how to be a, you know, responsible citizen is what they say. Mm-hmm. And then they, with their, you know, kind of public-private partnership with the company that handles that social credit score, monitors and surveils everyone's activities and then kind of assigns them their score based upon what they see. And so you're absolutely right that it's a little different and actually are planning to use artificial intelligence. And before Barbara Marx Hubbard died, she actually died in 2019, and she was working with Christopher Life as her protege on implementing something she called synergistic democracy. Now, within the independent movement right now, that's being pushed as what's called win-win democracy. And it's other uglier DEI version, omni-win democracy. Mm. So they want it to be more democratized in the way that they feel like people should have a say in how this system will sort of operate. But of course, they do it by equitable DEI standards.
Right.
Certain voices should have more say on how things should work. And it's definitely not localized. It really what they view the whole system as is the entire earth. And what they really want and what her followers were building before she died was something called NOOMAP. Now it's called S7. It's the actual technology that would make this resource-based or well-being economy work. So AI would determine what all the resources were. And this is what you see now actually also on the kind of the Andrew Yang side, the rise of this abundance network, right? Because we're saying we're not going to have this whole Club of Rome idea of there's, you know, resources are scarce, everybody needs to conserve, and we're going to have all these regulations because they realize that it really inhibits growth of our society. So instead, they are going to have AI be able to determine, yes, we have an abundance of resources. And not only that, it'll be able to know who needs those resources and be able to distribute them equitably. Mm. And so in this, you know, in a worldwide system, AI might decide that, you know, hey, you know, you don't need your land. Some immigrants that came here might need it more than you. Or, hey, those resources might be better redirected to someplace like Africa. And you're just going to have to do without for the good of society.
Right. Right. And as you point out, you know, they have this definition of selfishness, or another word they use is arrogance. I hear that a lot, too. And I always think back to there's a Chinese professor that's pretty high up in the Chinese government. And he wanted to have Xi Jinping, president of China, have a book reading at a bookstore called Poetry and Prose. And the guy, and it's a bookstore in D.C., and the guy said, no, I'm not interested in holding your book reading here. I'm not a communist. I don't want the communist president using my store. And the Chinese professor telling the story says, the arrogance of this American, the arrogance to think that he can keep us out of it. And it's like, you know, maybe that is arrogant, but it's not. It's just being an American. It means that when you're on American soil, Xi Jinping, the president of China or the queen of Timbuktu are no better or more superior than the owner of the bookshop. He gets to tell you to get the hell out because it's his land. And it doesn't matter if you're the king of China. Get out. So it's like this idea of our sovereignty, our individualism, our, you know, control over our own property. That is seen by these people as arrogant, as selfish, all these bad things. When, you know, we've been raised to understand, no, this is what it means to be an American. This is actually, we have freedom to do what we want. It's not arrogance to not bend the knee. It's sovereignty. And that's what we're, you know, holding on to. So I think that's very insightful, this idea of selfishness, being that your freedom is selfishness. You're being selfish by demanding freedom or to inherit your birthright. That's selfish. You should give it to somebody else. It's that sort of evocative language that gets people to go along with this, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And they're really just trying to change the entire system. It's not just how the resources are distributed, but also they're trying to completely change our election systems for two reasons, right? The independent movement has been struggling to get ballot access. It's been very hard for them. And I actually do agree that the two-party system is not perfect.
Right.
And there's lots of changes that could be made. But really what they're trying to drive us towards is ranked choice voting or what they call preferential voting or final five voting, where it would take away the one person, one vote aspect of America and our electoral college so that they can then kind of have more of a quote unquote democracy, which is really just mob rule.
Right.
And they view people wanting to keep our constitution and keep our electoral college as selfish.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm amazed at how this language and this mindset has sort of seeped its way into the public consciousness. And again, this article gets into some crazy stuff. I want to touch on Epstein, how his whole deal associates with this, the transhumanist aspect. But just reading it and just this idea of we're evolving into this new non-human, you know, advanced race or, you know, whatever their idea is. You might not hear it explicitly a lot, but I had a friend who was talking to a group of people about transgenderism, and one of the people was a major leftist. And the leftist said, just apropos of nothing, just out of nowhere, said, well, you know, we're all transitioning. My friend said, well, what do you mean we're all? And they said, well, we're all transitioning out of being human into being transhuman. So it's like this is already just part of the public consciousness. People are being trained to accept this idea that humanity is on the cusp of some evolutionary breakthrough where we're going to leave behind all these stupid old traditions and, you know, sex divisions and gender. And that's all the old because we are this new, this neo-human, this neo-man that doesn't have to abide by all these traditional things. So, I mean, this has already have a very powerful hold on the public consciousness. And that to me is extremely disturbing. And it's also extremely like powerful, like it makes me respect these people for how they're able to get their ideas seeped into the public consciousness. Even when nobody knows who they are or what they're doing, their ideas are being embedded.
Well, and actually, you're on the right track here, but what people don't understand is that it already has been mainstreamed into the public. Right. So your audience can go check out how powerful some of these evolutionary leaders are and read their biographies on their webpage, evolutionaryleaders.net. You'll see that many of these people are members of the Club of Rome, members of the Club of Budapest, the World Economic Forum. Many of them are very influential at the United Nations. And actually, many of them have been platformed for decades on Oprah Winfrey's television show. And this is why, you know, when you saw big things happen like The Secret, you know, and this whole idea that people can right. use the law of manifestation to manifest things in their lives, this is all a part of this evolutionary leader's cult and their ideology. And it's not just, it is a religion for sure, but also it's a way of viewing the world that we are not dualistic, you know, separated from the metaphysical, separated from animals and environments and all that kind of stuff, but we are literally one body. And therefore our needs as humans don't matter as much as the biosphere or insects, you know, right. And this is where you see like the WHO's One Health agenda come through. And many of these people are connected to the World Health Organization. And so this cult has been able to influence and infiltrate all areas of society. They restructured education in the 90s. They, like I said, have and been involved in Silicon Valley. Literally every single sector you can think of, they were the ones who were behind the environmental, social, and governance scores in business. So this is an actual cult with real chops and real influence in our culture already.
It's very, very disturbing. And I guess they get away with it by just treating like this is just intellectualism. It's not a religion. It's not we're enforcing our religious views. It's just, we're just intellectuals. And this is just, you know, the academic way of viewing the world. And it's just sick, and it's having incredible, you know, consequences as we see. I mean, like you say, since the 90s, we've seen our curriculum change. And it seems like everything these people touch gets significantly worse and not fit for purpose anymore. But that hasn't ever stopped them before. And tell us, so we got Christopher Life, Brock Pierce. This is a child actor from the Mighty Ducks movie. What does he have to do with this? And how is this related to the independent, you know, party movement And is Elon Musk's America Party playing into that in any way, do you think? Because when I think of a third party option, that's the one that's, you know, grabbing headlines these days. How do you think that relates to it?
Well, I think it's important to note that Christopher Life isn't operating by himself. He's using the finances of the Brock Pierce Foundation and they're working as co-founders, basically running these independent national conventions to kind of rival what's going on with the Republican Democrat parties. And they're also, again, forming a coalition called United Independence within the independent movement that'll kind of coalesce resources and, you know, an actual platform of what they're supporting and eventually candidates that they want to throw their weight behind as an independent movement. And Brock Pierce was a child star. He was, like you said, he's in the Mighty Ducks movies, and he was turned into a cryptocurrency bro. And he was actually a financial advisor in that realm for Jeffrey Epstein. And I think the other thing that I wanted to note, there's some very questionable stuff of him living with this guy named Mark Collins Rector. There's this whole scandal with kind of an early version of Netflix called the Digital Entertainment Network, where there was accusations of an actual sex ring going on. Where producers would come to the house where he lived with Collins Rector and his lover, Chad Shackley. And there was supposedly things going on there. Now, he was never prosecuted, but I feel like in relation to his relationship with Epstein, I think it's something to definitely bring up. Brock Pierce was invited and attended a conference that Epstein had on his little St. James Island in 2011 called Mindshift. And it was a conference to discuss evolution. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about the blackmail aspect, maybe the intelligence aspect of what Epstein was doing on his island and in his ranch in New Mexico. But we don't talk enough about something that's not as well known, which is his very, very deep interest in, you know, kind of social and genetic engineering. Through his relationship with many, many scientists who are studying those types of things. He funded them. He would have them to lunches and dinners. He funded the whole program for evolutionary dynamics at Harvard that actually Harvard got in hot water for after he was prosecuted. And so I think we're not maybe questioning that there might have been evolutionary motives behind what Epstein was up to, especially considering two of the survivors, both Virginia Giuffre in that recent kind of Dead Man Switch recording she put out, was talking about how, you know, Bill Gates, of course, they hated seeing him naked on Epstein Island, but also he would bring genetic experiments or stuff to inject people with him. One of the things that was mentioned. One of the other victims recalled waking up at the Zora Ranch in New Mexico and was on like a medical table. And there were people in medical gear around her and they were injecting her with something. And she questions, what did they do to me? So I think that we definitely need to examine, were there evolutionary motives, transhumanist motives behind what was happening with Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And again, it's in this article, and the crew is showing all these other articles from, you know, Hollywood Reporter about Brock Pierce and Jeffrey Epstein. So, I mean, all this stuff is verified by mainstream sources. But your article, The Cult Capture of the Independent Movement, How Third Party Politics is Being Used to Usher in a Technocracy for Global Consciousness, will be up on InfoWars today, probably very shortly, but we have sort of the advanced copy here. And when we get back on the other side, I'll read just some of what you report about scientists like George Church and the World Transhumanist Association. So again, folks, I mean, it might sound crazy to people that don't know some of this stuff already, but it's like, yeah, when you're talking about transhumanism and a social credit score and it's tied in with Jeffrey Epstein and all these other, you know, fundraisers and high connected people, the World Economic Forum, the WHO. I mean, they really are tied in together. They really are pursuing a single agenda, and it is not for your, it's not in your best interest, and it's not for humanity. They actually see humanity as maybe a stepping stone or maybe an obstacle to their ultimate goals. And we'll get into, you know, how those are being manifested right now in real life. Not something far down the line. It's happening right now as we speak, and we have to stop it. Stay with us.
I need support.
We are maxed out, and I can do so much more in offense, guaranteed beat them even faster in court. And got this other stuff going on. I'll leave it at that with the Justice Department, the good guys coming in, and the task force on weaponization, that I need funds. So I need you to go to thealexjonesstore.com, subscribe as your monthly donation for $30 a month as a VIP, and know you're doing that bare minimum of support, cancel any time. Not a very hard commitment. You just do it. Month to month, you charge $30. You're a VIP, and when you want a t-shirt or you want a supplement, you get it, because it'll just build up in your account. $40 to spend in the store. You spend 30, you get 40 automatic discounts on everything, special sales, special offers. I'm asking everyone to commit, who's never supported the broadcast by buying anything, to become a VIP today at thealexjonesstore.com. And then you know you're doing the monthly support. Ever have an issue, don't want to do it, cancel. One click, it's your profile. But by being a VIP, you get massive discounts, special offers, and so much more at thealexjonesstore.com. And it's a way to show your support. We need your backing. I am 100% dauntless. If anything, I get overheated because I've got so much energy and I'm so angry at these people and it bleeds off into my life. I need your backing. I'm backing you. Quite frankly, if you don't back me and my crew, what we're doing, you're nuts. And I'm not mad at you. I'm just saying you're crazy. Evil hates this transmission. We've got their number. And if you don't back the organizations fighting with everything they've got for you, because we're all in this together, well, you've rolled over. You've run up the white flag, quite frankly. And that's what this is. People ask, man, thanks for fighting. Thanks for never giving up. Wow, why does it break your spirit? It intensifies my spirit. To know we're up against pure evil and we're turning the tide and we're winning. And then to know that if we don't fight hard, they're going to win and commit humanity to a nightmare of evil. You think stuff's bad now? You ain't seen nothing yet. Thank me for fighting for my own future and yours collectively. There's not even a question of fighting these people. Look at them. They've got to be opposed. People tend to think being persecuted is, oh, you want to stay away from that. Oh, so you want to stay away from the fight. No, it's like John Paul Jones said when he got commissioned as the head of the U.S. Navy, and Riley was starting, and he was writing to the Continental Congress. He said, I only want the fastest ships. I only want to be sent into the main war zones and direct action. They said, here, it's our fastest ship. Go out. He immediately goes out and engages and takes over all these British ships, two, three times the size. It's a ramming straight into them. Well, that's what I want to do. I only want the fastest ships. I want to go directly into action. I want to go 24 hours a day. I want reporters all over the country. I want to be 50 times stronger against the enemy. I want 50 times the audience. I want victory. You think what we've done to the enemy has been effective so far? It's nothing. I have not yet begun to fight. So support yourself. Support us. Do it. Or be conscious that you didn't fight when the time was right. You hesitated. You took this as another entertainment venue, just some other show, just more talk. This ain't talk. This is the targeting coordinates to take down the enemy. This is the Death Star plans. This is Sting, the Goblin Slayer. They hate this blade. This operation is a sword that is plunged politically, culturally, spiritually into the hearts of our enemies over and over and over again. They hate it. It's a standard of their defeat. It's a symbol of their weakness. That's what we're doing here. This is serious business. So I'm coming to you, asking you to continue to commission us in this fight. We've already delivered you more victories against the enemy than any other media operation in the world. And I'm asking you again for all of our collective futures to come to our aid now more and take your fight to the 110% level. Tell the truth. Be accurate. Stand against evil. Have courage. Until it's not even having courage, it's what you are.
Putting the power of conversation into the caller's hands. You're listening to The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The American Journal. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, here with Lisa Logan, talking about her bombshell new article, or it will be a bombshell when it drops later today on Infowars.com. Let me get the exact title of this article. The Cult Capture of the Independent Movement, How Third-Party Politics is Being Used to Usher in a Technocracy for Global Consciousness. And this is sort of the ultimate conspiracy, the conspiracy that all the constituent conspiracies are driving us towards. And I was just thinking about that during the break, looking at at this article and think about how all of these things are being so rapidly implemented. And just making a quick list off the top of my head, obviously you have, you know, stories that I talked about earlier. We covered them yesterday, of AI being used in hiring practices or as a de facto social credit score, where basically you'll lose your job if you say the wrong thing online, express the wrong sentiments. You have the Online Safety Act that was just passed in the UK, totally censoring everybody, forcing you to provide your digital ID or, you know, link some other biometric information in order to just see information that they'll still censor from you if they don't want you to see it anyway. Facial recognition is becoming much more widespread. Now, if you go to the airport, they don't even ask to see your ID. They just ask you to look at the lens, please. And they take your photo. Now we have variable pricing, because what I was thinking of was the way that China implements the social credit system is very savvy. It's very sophisticated. They won't necessarily deny you things. They just make it more expensive, or they make it harder, or they make it less convenient, right? And I can just see how this plays out, where as you're arguing, going, well, this is unfair because I have a low credit score. I can't get on the high speed train. And I can just see the argument being made. Well, yeah, but you can still get on a train. It's not like they're stopping you from getting on a train. You just have to take the regional. It's just going to take you 12 hours instead of 2 hours, but they aren't actually stopping you. So it's this subtle implementation. It's the soft implementation. It's the, well, we aren't stopping you, but we just are going to make it a little harder. And that made me think about the variable pricing that's being implemented in all sorts of cases in America. Delta has announced variable pricing. And I've got the article from the Chicago Tribune. Editorial, a pox on personalized airline pricing at Delta or elsewhere. We're not up for surge pricing at the grocery store either. So that's being implemented, this sort of soft social credit score where they, well, you can afford more, so we're going to charge you more. And that person, so you don't have a single price that everybody pays. You have prices tailored to that person's, you know, capabilities. And then that just adds to the renting and not owning, where you aren't going to own your phone or your house or your car. It'll all be rented. Tesla auto driving. I mean, again, I'm sorry to ramble because we have Lisa Logan here. He's the expert on all of this. But just as I was running through my mind during the break of all of these things that have all been implemented in just the last few weeks or months, and they're all coming together to provide the foundation and the infrastructure for the global consciousness initiative that you're describing here. So I'm sorry to ramble, but I mean, I'm sure you're noticing all of this as well. All of these things are being implemented all over the place all at once.
Right. And I think it's like you said, it's a frog boiling in a pot of water. It comes along kind of incrementally. Maybe it's just a pilot in your town. That's how they started with the airport biometric stuff, right? Oh, it's just a pilot, but they don't tell you that. They don't tell you that you're not going to be detained to get on your flight, right, if you don't participate in their pilot program. And it's just like how we have smartphones, right? And we, you know, have the choice of accepting the terms and conditions of using, right, that phone. But I mean, good luck using your phone in society if you don't have one. And you won't be able to do that unless you set those terms and conditions. And so we're slowly being kind of steered into this society where, again, everything will be digitally connected. And I think it's important to talk about those technologies. You are an expert, Harrison, because you're here reporting the news and showing how it actually is being implemented and promoted within our society. And the problem is, once you're interconnected like that, a lot of people think, oh, it's so great. You know, well, it's convenient. I'll be able to pull up my medical records on my digital wallet if I have to go somewhere and show that I'm up to date on my vaccines. But in a world like China, where they can take your ability to, again, ride a high speed train away or turn your health code red if you attend a protest, it's not the freedom and the choice that people really think it is. And so it's an important thing for us to talk about how these technologies really are going to set up a system where we're going to have to comply with what those rules are. And those could be, and who's going to set those rules? Who's going to train the AI to say, these are the rules that are acceptable for this person to have access to these goods and services?
And yes, and what are their values and what are their philosophies? And we know, we were talking about earlier, they think freedom is selfish and your sovereignty is arrogance and you have to be brought down. And I guess it makes sense. It's easier to bring everybody who's, you know, superlative, bring them down to the average, a lot easier to do that than it is to bring the bottom up. So, yeah, I guess technically it makes sense what they're doing. It's just, you know, evil. It's just destroying the, you know, human potential that we have on offer. And, you know, not to get too far off the mark, I was, you know, brainstorming that during the break. But before the break, we were talking about Epstein and his creepy activity. So let's get back to that, not let that fall to the wayside. This is from your article that, again, will be published on InfoWars shortly. Two of Epstein victims, Virginia Giuffre in her Dead Man Switch recording and Juliette Rose Bryant, have alleged that there were genetic experiments going on at both his private Virgin Island and Zorro Ranch in New Mexico. He surrounded himself with scientists like George Church, who was working, quote, to identify genes that could be altered to create superior humans, and gave large sums of money to the World Transhumanist Association. The article goes on to say that Mr. Epstein's vision reflected his longstanding fascination with what has become known as transhumanism, the science of evolving, of improving the human population through technologies like genetic engineering and artificial intelligence. So all these things are again, combining and accelerating. They're talking now about, in the UK, babies being born that have three sets of genetic code in them. So, I mean, transhumanism is here, isn't it? I mean, are you warning about something that's coming, or are you telling people about something that's already happening right now, Lisa?
Well, I mean, let's just be real. Epstein was having these billionaires dinners, inviting all these scientists and members from Transhumanist Association to talk about how do we make this a reality. It is already happening in a lot of ways. Yeah. Again, you have, I guess, surveillance. You have test tube babies or experimenting with artificial wombs. This is a real thing. People are already experimenting with how do we enhance. And you know, some of those things could be great. But you see, again, you can insert a chip in your hand and be able to pay with things. But again, what happens when they shut that off for you? Smart meters are being installed on people's water systems that they can shut off if it's a part of a centralized system that decides you've used too much water. And so these technologies to control us, and as well as enhance our capabilities as humans, already are starting to exist. And so I want to bring up, too, then the fact that, you know, Elon has been great getting all the waste, fraud, and abuse out of the federal government with his DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency. And he says his new party is going to advocate for, responsible national debt policy, you know, as far as reducing the national debt, because he feels the two main parties aren't very kind of zeroed in on that. But will his America Party, what else will they advocate for? Will they advocate for these fourth industrial revolution technologies as well that merge the physical, digital, and biological spheres? And the answer is yes. And actually, from my article, it says he's obviously has a company, Neuralink, and which advocates for brain implantable interfaces. And his 2023 post regarding his social media platform X evolving to, quote, be the collective consciousness of humanity, yeah, or more accurately, the human machine collective, which has now been conveniently merged with XAI, as we know, and also his stated desire to make X the everything app, similar to the Chinese WeChat, which is the system that holds all of that into place. It's safe to say that yes, he is for these technologies. And so I think just going to the ballot box, or, you know, kind of pausing for a minute to, cause I think actually that all of this political theater that we're seeing over the, you know, how much was released about the Epstein case and the Big Beautiful Bill dispute, I think all of this is political theater to make both the left and the right-hand side of government, conservatives and Republicans and Democrats, look bad, so that it actually drives us to this middle way third-party politics that is advocating for these technologies.
Yeah, and especially with Elon, both Peter Thiel as well, mm-hmm, it's hard to get a read on how I feel. I'm sure you saw the video. I'd love to get your comments when Peter Thiel was asked about, like, aren't you kind of building the infrastructure that the Antichrist would use? You know, if you're warning against the Antichrist, well, here you are building all of the programs you say that that the Antichrist would need to use, aren't you? And it's like Peter Thiel never thought about that before. He's like, huh, yeah, I guess I am kind of building, you know, paving the way for the Antichrist. And it's like, Okay, has he actually never thought about that? Or I don't know what to make of these guys. Clearly, Elon Musk, I was just thinking about this the other day because, you know, every once in a while it'll happen where I'll bring up Twitter on my phone and the app will just kind of freeze up. And I always get this flashback to like 2 or 3 years ago when I never knew if my Twitter account was going to be there or not, right? I mean, censorship was real and intense. And if you had to be careful, and it was not a rare occurrence for me to flip on Twitter to see, sorry, you've been banned. So thank God for Elon Musk opening up Twitter. Thank God for Elon Musk helping Trump get elected. I don't want to throw the guy under the bus. At the same time, he's obviously a transhumanist. How do you deal with that? How do we deal with these people that seemingly are on our side, seemingly love humanity, and yet they're paving the way for this technocracy? I mean, how do you deal with these characters?
Yeah, and actually, I thought you were going to ask me about the video that I saw with Peter Thiel, where the guy was asking him, do you still believe that humans should exist in the future?
Right.
And you kind of had a very kind of uncomfortable long pause before he said, well, it's complicated. And then had this long answer. I'm like, that's the kind of stuff that concerns me again, because
seriously,
they view humans as the ultimate consumption entity in our ecosystem, and that we are exploitative of the rest of the resources. And so I think you have to view people for who they are. And I think we can, in the same sentence, appreciate Elon's cutting of, this waste and abuse at the government. I'm so grateful he cut USAID. And also, you know, his taking over of X, although I would agree I'm just a censor, to be honest.
Right.
But I think we can appreciate those things and in the same sentence point out that, hey, it's not okay for you to set up this digital infrastructure to control all of humanity. I think we need to point that stuff out when it happens as citizens. I think, you know, you had Courtney Turner on your show the other day talking about this AI.gov stuff. I mean, yep. I think we need to point that stuff out and say, no, we were not for it. 10 years ago, we're still not for it. We want to have ultimate freedom and cognitive liberty, and we do not want you to set up a system of control that can allow that to happen.
And as you point out in your article, it's not even a matter of, I don't know how to put it, it's just they don't have a right to impose their beliefs on us, especially even if I agreed with their beliefs, I wouldn't want them imposed. But these people, I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know what the basis of their understanding is. As you point out, how would one make sure that only the good can evolve? Because they talk about, you know, well, some people just have to die and other people will evolve and some people won't. Well, how do you make sure that only the good can evolve? Moreover, who or what defines good? A system would have to be created to track, quote, selfish people and force them to comply either through coercion, nudging, or force, and to leave them no other option to participate in society without plugging themselves into that system. So again, that to me is the superlative concern is, what these people define as good, I don't define as good. What they define as selfish, I don't define as selfish. And yet they're going to, and they are, they're just doing it. Again, they're not asking permission. They're not saying, we'd like to set up the system. Will you allow us? And we all get to vote. And if the majority, no, they're just doing it, right? So they're just imposing this on us unless we stop them. So I guess let's turn to that. How do we stop them? What do we need to be doing to, you know, cut them off at the pass and prevent them, so we're not always just playing catch up as they implement these technologies and we, you know, point them out and point out how evil they are and point out where they're going? How do we head them off at the pass? How do we stop them from implementing this before it's too late?
I think we have to create policies at the local level that shield our local society from these things. Now, I don't know what we do globally. I think we have to get some, and even nationally, right, we have to get some congressmen on board who are willing to make those same laws at that level as well to say these things cannot be implemented. I think we have to also really cut these public-private partnerships, because that is what is driving all of this into our culture, because that is really taxation without representation. You're having unelected bodies decide things for us regular people without even a vote in place. So I think that's the one thing. And then I think overall, just making yourself aware of what these movements are called and what they're doing, to kind of set up this infrastructure. There's actually a website called secondrenaissance.net, second spelled out, that'll show you all the metamodernist, and economic, groups that are working together to put this in place. In the intellectual dark web space, we have Game B, Again, I mentioned the NOAMAP S7 people. You have all of the folks who are in that well-being economy agenda that I talked about when I was exposing the federal plan for equitable long-term recovery and resilience. There's actual webs of these people on the internet on Kaggle, and you can find them and realize that they're using all aspects, media, they're using their friends in the United Nations, which again, they're very influential. They're setting all this digital, rules for how they're going to fight disinformation and misinformation and just start saying no, show up, speak up, and assert your cognitive and physical liberty.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the type of thing that the purpose of these programs, in part at least, is to stop you from speaking out against the program. So it's like once they're implemented, it's too late. Talking about this yesterday, mm-hmm. either with the Online Safety Act or, now they've got, anti-Semitism monitors in places like Facebook. And so once they're in place, if you say, hey, it's not good that the, Jewish Zionist organization gets to censor Facebook, they go, well, too bad. That violates our rules. So we're going to remove it. Or the Online Safety Act. If you say, I don't like this, they can say, well, that's actually against the rules of the Online Safety Act, so we'll remove that. So if you want to stop this, you have to stop it before it happens. Once it's implemented, it's too late. Once the social credit score is established, that's pretty much the end for any revolutionary activity, any change whatsoever, because they can nip it in the bud. They can take any nascent or, starting to develop revolutionary concept and just crush it outright or silence you or separate you away from everybody else. Another thing that happened recently that reminds me of everything that you're laying out is that the Waymo cars refused to take people to the protests in California during the immigration protest. And obviously that was because they were attacking the Waymo cars. But it, again, it's sort of a symbol of how this is already being implemented, how if you want to go protest the government, well, not if it violates Waymo's terms of service, not if Tesla right. says, sorry, your protest against the government violates our position. We're not going to take you there. How are you going to gather? So, just making the point that we got to head this off at the pass. Once these things are implemented, it's too late to try to solve them, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And again, it's being driven by these public-private partnerships that are slowly taking away our other options. If we don't want to participate in, a self-driving car or whatever, eventually that's all the options we'll have left. So I think fighting for options also to continue to have them and not be plugged into this system is important as well.
So you get into all of this in your article, and it's, again, people not aware of how real all of this is. I get that it might sound crazy. You got Elon, you got Epstein, you got transhumanism and the Chinese communist model. And it's just a wide ranging article because it's such a wide ranging conspiracy that they're involved in. And so again, the sort of central point of it is this literal cult that you're describing, founded by Barbara Marx Hubbard and now, being carried out by Christopher Life. Why have I not heard of these people before? I mean, I'm in this sphere all the time. I'm always reading about this stuff. But these people have slipped by my vision. How did I miss these guys? Are they good at hiding themselves, or am I not doing the right research? How did I miss these people?
Well, actually, you probably haven't. I'll point out that some people who are no longer on the Evolutionary Leaders website, probably on purpose, but a two-time presidential candidate, Marian Williamson, was a evolutionary leader on their website, has now been scrubbed. You have people like Deepak Chopra. Gosh, how much has he been in the media for all sorts of various things that he's promoted? They're more in plain sight than you think they are. And I will also point out Jean Houston, who's another evolutionary leader, was spiritual advisor to Hillary Clinton. Hmm. So they are there and they're influential, but many of them kind of work behind the scenes at places like the United Nations. Again, they were responsible for the SDGs. They were responsible for the complete restructuring of education through Clinton's Goals 2000. Literally everything that I've come on your show and talked about, Harrison, they have played a role in. Right. That federal plan for equitable long-term recovery and resilience, four of them are listed on their chart as white sages. Wow. So they are very much a part of our society without you knowing it.
Wow. Yeah. It's, It's very disturbing, and I wish we had longer with you, because I want to get into what's happening in the World Economic Forum right now. It seems like they're maybe not as influential as they were a few years ago, and I'm wondering if they're reorganizing in some other organization, or if they're... I think we won. I think we exposed them for who they are, and so they just don't have any credibility anymore. So it's not beneficial for them to send out Noah Yuval Harari out, because people just get creeped out by him and don't like what he's up to. So I wonder how the information landscape is changing with things like the World Economic Forum falling out of favor as InfoWars and people like yourself expose what they're up to. It seems like they're going a little bit more underground and being a little bit more hidden. Have you noticed that?
I definitely have. And I think behind the scenes, they are forming coalitions within themselves. I know one of the evolutionary leaders, Mark Gurzon, actually got the Social Venture Network and the World Economic Forum to sit down and shake hands over their agenda. And so quietly behind the scenes, the UN and the WEF are working together, as well as some of these other very radical non-governmental organizations. And again, I just want to say, with the digital sphere, the evolutionary leaders set the whole entire agenda for the Summit of the Future last year. I went on Dr. Drew's show to talk about it. And really what they're doing is the digital control of all society. Again, they get to decide what's misinformation. So you have AI, Google Jigsaw deciding, oh, hey, if you're saying something on the internet we don't like, we're going to send you into a private chat room with an AI bot. Yeah. And they're going to school you on the proper way to say that. So I just think that don't lose sight of kind of this agenda doesn't go away. It just transforms. Mm. And so we have to be on top of and in front of what it's transforming into so that we can continue to say no.
And it's not enough just to say no. You gotta put your foot down. We gotta have laws in place. You gotta have the two-prong approach. You gotta say no on an individual level, but we gotta combine. We gotta, organize and stage protests and just make people aware of what's going on so we can get some political movement against it, because they're not gonna stop. We have to stop them. And that, again, is sort of always the message whenever, I'm joined by Lisa Logan. It's always, here's what these people are up to. Now it's time to go out and stop them ourselves, not just beg for their mercy. They have none. Lisa Logan, thank you so much for joining us. You can follow Lisa on X at I Am Lisa Logan, on YouTube at Parents of Patriots 6581. The article that you gotta read and share is called The Cult Capture of the Independent Movement, How Third Party Politics is Being Used to Usher in Technocracy for Global Consciousness. And that will be published later today on Infowars.com. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. At I Am Lisa Logan on X. Go follow her and inform yourself. Folks, that's about going to do it for us. But I do got to tell you, they just delivered this very important piece of paper here. Store-wide, buy one, get one, super sale for VIPs only on thealexjonesstore.com. Buy one, get one on all supplements and all apparels while supply lasts. Unlock massive savings with our store-wide buy one, get one super sale at thealexjonesstore.com, where VIP members can score buy one, get one deals on all supplements and apparel to supercharge your wellness and style. You're going to look as good as you feel, folks. This exclusive offer is reserved for our VIP Club Elites, giving you unbeatable value on top quality products that fuel your fight for truth and freedom. Join the VIP Club today for just $30 a month. Cancel anytime. You instantly get $40 in store credit plus access to this epic sale. Do not miss out. Sign up now. Double up on your savings. Support the InfoWar.
Just got in my methylene blue, ultra methylene blue USP grade from thealexjonesstore.com. And I've heard all the rants and raves about this. Really interested to see how I'm going to feel. I'm going to do a third dropper and then some water right now. And I am going to see, that's plenty. Maybe that's a little bit more. I'm going to mix this up. And pretty excited to see how this is going to work. So after I fully drink this, I will let everybody know the effects of, hopefully, of what is the unlimited power.
What's going on, Xers? Jay Rocket here. Just giving y'all an update. It's been an hour past doing the one dropper of the ultramethylene blue USP grade, the alexjonesstore.com. currently at the gym right now, and it's hard to explain what I feel other than I do feel the mental clarity. I don't have any cloudy thoughts. My focus seems relaxed, but very on point. And the energy kind of feels clean, no jittery, things like that. I haven't really felt any tingling or anything. Maybe if I'll even probably take a, you know, an extra dropper next time. This is on an empty stomach as well. So definitely feel just cool, calm, and collected, but very focused, very centralized. It's a very calm zen feeling. So if you haven't gotten to try this stuff yet, y'all need to go to the alexjonesstore.com and get your methylene blue today.